Would you prefer to delay and have us move another topic in place until?
Exactly. I mean, we can, in order to meet and to make sure we do it all in one go. If you've got an item you can take comfortably before this, then I'm not cool with that.
Well, my problem is that the next item on the agenda would be presented by Louis Tuton, who is not here. Then the next one has to do with registration transfer rules, and I don't know whether Dan Hellerman is here either.
He's not ready.
And then I know that Ms. Swinehart is not in the room because she wasn't expecting to have to be here till 4:30. Well, perhaps we should begin and...
Okay.
Oh, there's Louis. All right. Let's, Louis, is it possible that we could advance your report on the sponsored TLD agreements while Mr. Shepherd waits for some of his colleagues to arrive?
Thank you.
Nothing like catching you literally as you walk in the door. Thank you for that accommodation. So just for the record, we are advancing now the sponsored TLD agreements report and the status for .pro presented by Louis Tuton, and we will then go back to the DNSO Names Council report.
Thank you. As described in a recent report we posted on the web, to summarize, we have the board last November approved 4 unsponsored TLDs and 3 sponsored TLDs. Of the 4 sponsored TLDs, agreements have been signed with 3 of them, and they are busy making preparations to actually go live with registered names beginning within the next couple of weeks for .info. The other unsponsored TLD is .pro, with which we have not yet reached an agreement. I'll talk more about pro at the end of my remarks. The 3 sponsored TLDs are .aero, .coop, and .museum. We have, with all 3 of the sponsors of those, reached an agreement on a basic form of an agreement, which has 23 attachments that are designed to accommodate the differences between them. If Ben would roll down to the bottom of this page, there is a table that shows that we have posted all of the attachments for museum. We have posted some of the attachments for .aero. No, you were at the right place. And we are working with .coop and expect soon to reach to settle many of the attachments there. The staff will be suggesting to the board tomorrow that for the sponsored TLDs, it would be appropriate that the agreement be approved for .museum to be executed by the president with any correction of minor errors and the like, and that for .aero and .coop, that the staff will suggest that it would be appropriate for a slightly modified version of the 7-day procedure that was used for the unsponsored TLDs be used. Modified in the sense that the staff would complete posting once it had reached, had completed all of the attachments, and would then advise the board that, in its view, the attachments in the agreement are in substantial conformity with the proposal that was made to the board in which the selection was made last November, And any board member would then have 7 days to object in much the same fashion as has been used for unsponsored TOVs. But that if, which we do not anticipate for .arrow or .coop, there are any significant deviations that we should then advise the board of that, and the board could then decide how to proceed, including the possibility of some public comment in a more formalized way. We do have a number of details left to do with Arrow and Co-op. They've both assured us in the negotiations that they have every intent to live fully up to their proposal that they made and on the basis on which they were selected. And we hope to move forward on that basis in the next few weeks. Turning to .pro, and then I want to come back to one important issue relating to all of the sponsored TLDs, as to which there may be something I'd like particularly public comment on. With respect to .pro, the operator of that, which was a joint venture, has had difficulties with their joint venture partners agreeing on an overall plan that would be in conformity with their original proposal in terms of providing the resources that they proposed to provide. I am told this morning that they have a solution has been worked out to overcome that. I haven't yet seen it, and would then be reluctant to say much about that, except that our intent, unless the board instructs us otherwise, is to insist that these negotiations be completed rapidly and not hang on longer, so that they should be completely posted within approximately 6 weeks, and that if the changes they have are significant, that we would then present those to the board, and the board could then decide how to proceed if the changes are such that some other process other than the usual 7-day approval period is appropriate. Let me turn now to an important issue with the sponsored TLDs that's been much discussed during some of the constituency meetings, having to do with the sponsors' use of competitive registrars. All three sponsors that were selected proposed to use competitive registrars, in most cases after a fairly brief startup period. The sponsored TLDs here, at least in the case of, well, in all three cases, expect to be tens or hundreds of thousands of registrations. But a concern has been raised that what if they don't get large, and as one of them put it to me, they remain in the four digits rather than graduating to a five, that is not above 10,000 registrations. Shouldn't there be some accommodation that relieves them from the cost of operating any kind of competitive registrar system, given that the competitive consequences of that for such a small top-level domain are slight? I must say I'm personally somewhat sympathetic with that. In some cases, it's not quite in line with exactly what they proposed. Again, what they proposed at most was a startup period of several months, 6 months or so, in which they would graduate out of that. But I would like to have guidance from the board, and I'm sure the board would like guidance from the community on whether that kind of additional accommodation would be acceptable. And so that's generally the status of the STLDs and .pro.
Thank you very much, Louis. Are there any questions from the board on this report? Well, from the floor? Very good, thank you. Oh, I see there is one from Armadale, please.
It's not a question to Louis, it's just a question to these registry, to these sponsoring organizations, if they are present, have any remark to add to his report.
Mr. Chairman, I would point out that because of the change of schedule, all of these registries represented in the room. I see one of them, but not the others.
In that case, taking the point that they might have expected this to come later, when that time comes, I will invite comment, assuming that they have come into the room. Thank you.
I think that would be a good for not only for them, but we encountered a situation where several registrars, as one might predict, had some opinions about these issues.
Yes, so we will accommodate that and appreciate it, Stuart, if you would remind me if I seem to have forgotten that I need to address that when the time comes. Thank you very much, Lee. I'd like to now turn back to the DMSO report. Mr. Shepherd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're now 4 out of 5, which I think is good enough to proceed, and we hope that by the end of that we will have our last rapporteur joining us away from the lures of Uruguayan cuisine. So Philip Shepherd with the a report on some key issues currently occupying the names council and the DNSO. First topic is review, and the working group we have on review, if you recall, is looking at implementing a few key and specific items currently within the business plan of the Names Council that follow on from the outreach work in terms of the working group review report. We now believe in a position to be producing an interim report within the next couple of weeks, and this will include the following features. Some suggested guidelines in terms of the operation of working groups. These are a short and practical version of the more extensive deliberations in a working group review report. We'll include some suggested criteria, a few simple Q&A, in terms of the criteria that should be applied to the formation of new constituencies. These are intended to amplify and extend the suggested slow down. These are intended to amplify and extend the current wording in the bylaws of ICAM. We've been looking at options for cost-effective translation. This is all work in progress. We were essentially seeking to see if there were means of automated translation that would be suitable for purposes of certain DNSO documents, and as yet we have not found anything that we believe is, but nevertheless we'll continue to search. Another topic we're looking at there is alternatives for email-based fora for discussion. And there we made a point of using one such fora, a web-based system, for the work of the review group itself, and our conclusions on the efficacy of that versus simple email communication will be included in that report, together with brief comments in terms of our analysis and conclusions for no change to the existing process for the election of the chair of the General Assembly. Once those items are done, the interim report is out for consultation and approved, and the final report is produced, that will be the end of the task of the working group are currently entitled and review. We agreed at yesterday's meeting to have a new task force which will be looking at the structural issues currently facing us and the topics of hot debate here in Montevideo, namely the issues to do with the restructuring concerning the option for the CCSO, the at-large report, and the implications that have for the ongoing debate for an individual's constituency within the DNSO. So we'll be looking at those various overlap issues and finding the constituency consensus in terms of how they believe the future of the DNSO should be. And that concludes the two reports that I'm going to give in terms of those two items of work. And the next items I'm going to be talking about introducing other people to address your board. And the first of those is to do with who is with Paul Kane, followed by two reports by Guillermo Carey on .org and UDRP. Then there was a brief report from the CCSOs about the main deliberations of their meeting, of course, which concerned the restructuring And finally, if the rapporteur is here, we'll hear, I have a small report to make on the transfer issues. So without further ado, I'll invite Paul Kane, please, to come up here and brief the board in terms of the update on the HUA's work that we're doing within the Names Council and the DNSO.
Thank you. We have a few PowerPoint slides, please. Thank you. We conducted a survey starting on the 11th of June going through to the 14th of August, 9 weeks. It was a web and email, sorry, it was a web-based survey. We received web responses, email responses, and Word responses, just under 3,000. Predominantly, the responses were in English, although it should be noted that although alternative language versions were available, some nationals responded in English rather than the native version. 63 Japanese, 58 French, 57 Spanish, and 48 Russian. We were pleased with the diverse range of respondents. We received 1,048 commercial responses, 1,017 individual responses, 230 ISPs, 219 other. We had a free text box associated with the other, so we will be able to do some work to establish a little more detail on the other category. 207 non-commercial interest responses, 130 registrar or registree responses, and 35 governmental responses. What we are proposing to do now, the comment period having concluded, is to evaluate the comments submitted. The committee has not yet had access to all of the raw data, but ICANN is very kindly going to be providing the data to us in the format we have requested. We will be producing a report for submission to the Names Council, highlighting the areas of consensus that the survey has been able to establish, identify where more work is necessary. Then we propose to submit for peer review a draft report sometime in the spring of next year, and have open comments on the draft report, making the raw data available to the whole community so they can see the basis on which we wrote our report. Then following that comment period, to review the comments, finalize the report, and present it to the Names Council. We anticipate late spring, early summer 2002. So this is phase one of a program to look at the WHOIS issue. Thank you.
No questions?
Yes,
sir. Are there any questions?
Yes, I have a suggestion that you avoid using the names of the seasons of the year based on a northern hemisphere's perspective.
Yeah, that's true.
It's going to be the fall and the winter, okay, from the way I see it.
I assume those were southern hemisphere designations, given where we were.
Well, just on behalf of the interplanetary internet, the Mars folks really don't think that you should make reference to terrestrial, weather patterns and so on, because they're completely irrelevant. Thank you very much.
Paul, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like to give notice that anybody knows the whereabouts of Ken Stubbs or Chuck Gomez, I would be delighted to see them towards the front of the room. And in the meantime, Guillermo, please come up and give a report on .org and the UDRP work currently being done on the Names Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Guillermo Carey, Names Council, IPC representative. Now I'll try to give a brief explanation on the status of the .org task force. This task force is chaired by Milton Mullen from the non-commercial constituency, but he had to leave yesterday. The .org task force was formed in June, was originated by Board Resolutions 0171, which requests the consideration of the Names Council of the issues raised by the transition of the operation of the .org TLD from VeriSign to a new entity. The board resolution contains some principles that should be addressed by this report. A few of them are to address what should be the characteristics of the entity would be selected, the selection criteria, some policies that will rule the new .org responsible entity. The Names Council Forum Task Force is constituted by one member of the GA and one member for each constituency except of the ISPs. We've been working on a few principles that we might be able to agree before issuing a final report. And so far, after initial differences about the openness of this namespace, we can advance before a written report that there are some understandings basically in the following points. First, .org is to be a sponsored namespace, preferably by a non-commercial entity. Second, this is kind of new. It's a restricted but unrestricted namespace. This name is that will have a specific charter for non-commercial and non-profit organizations or individuals, but however, there will be no evictions and no remedies for those holders not complying with the charter. This will have a special effort on marketing purposes. It will be a namespace, marketed as a namespace for non-commercial interests exclusively. The administration will be consistent with the policy of ICANN, special stress or special remarks have been made that UDRP and WHOIS provisions should be maintained. And finally, the BNSO task force should help the ICANN staff in the draft for the request for a proposal to solicit applications and for the delegation and participate in discussions surrounding the selection of the new registry operator. About the timeline, we're expecting to end the first questionnaire or the first principles to be circulated and obtain and gather information from the public. And we hope to have put a final report for the vote, final vote and approval of the Names Council at the Los Angeles meeting. So that's why I can report about the .org. And if there are any questions, I can continue with UDRP.
Sure.
Yes, it's my understanding that these, as they come through in a final report, will be recommendations to the Names Council and possibly to the board. The reason I ask this is they're being characterized in the press as final decisions of ICANN. I just want to make sure I understand what the process is in the minds of the task force.
Yes, what do you have to say?
It is our understanding that this task force would make a recommendation to the Names Council. The Names Council will vote as a recommendation to the board, pursuant to Resolution 0171.
So if it should happen that the Names Council approves the report and forwards it to the board, presumably it could become a board action item at the November meeting. But that it doesn't mean that the board has necessarily adopted the report. It merely means it receives the report as of that time. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the floor? All right, thank you very much.
Okay, if I may, I will continue with the report on the UDRP task force. The chair of this task force, Caroline Chicoin, and co-chair is Milton Mueller. Both are not here, so I was asked to give this report as well. I must confess that I'm not a member of the task force, so I might not have all the answers, but this is what I can report for this moment.
The Names Council adopted in its 2001 business plan a review and evaluation of the UDRP. For these purposes, a Names Council interim committee drafted the terms of reference to conduct the review and its schedule, which will include the formation of an expert task force. The composition, together with the terms of reference of this expert task force, was approved together with the terms of reference by almost unanimous vote of the Names Council. The expert task force must draft and publish a questionnaire to gather public opinion and look to outside studies to incorporate the largest expertise possible in the report. The expert task force is not only a task force formed by Names Council members, but has made an effort to include other participants or active participants of the community in this regard. So besides each representative of each constituency, you will find in this task force, expert task force, complainants, panelists, and providers for the major resolution providers, such as CPR, E-Resolution, NAP, and WIFO. They have a GA member, independent ADR expert, independent academic expert. The original timeline was to have the questionnaire ready for September 15, submitted for public comment. The task force and the mailing list have just been formed, so we're afraid that that timeline will not be able to be complied, and a report will not be ready for November 12th. There's been some questions about the geographic diversity of the members of the expert task force. There are, from the 22 expert task force members, there are 16 from North America, 3 from the European Union, 1 from Latin America, 1 from the Asia Pacific region, and 1 from the African region. This lack of geographical diversity was noted not only in the interim committee, who selected part of its members, but also in the Names Council. And there are a few discussions on the way to attempt to include some people from different geographical regions. As I said, the report will be delayed until further notice. I can't respond when, but I'm not sure that we send that information in due course.
Just a question for clarification. The World Intellectual Property Organization recently released its second report. I cannot recall now whether that report gets into the UDRP, but if it does, it would be relevant to this task force's work, I think.
Thank you. There will be taken in consideration studies for some independent institutions, such as the Syracuse University, such as Max Planck Institute, and I definitely say that my report would qualify for those purposes.
Are there any other questions for this part of our report? Anything from the floor? Yeah, I think you're completed. Thank you so much for your
thank
help.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Shepherd.
I think, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, if my understanding is correct, the most recent WIPO report is concerning the second round of other entities that may be subjected to a process that could be similar to the UDRP, these are pharmaceutical names, etc. I think that report has just been finalized. So it doesn't address the detail of the existing UDRP. Jonathan's nodding to that. Thank you. I'd like to introduce, I think it's Chuck Gomez, who's going to speak on behalf of the discussions essentially taking part in the registrar's constituency on the issue of equitable allocation of SRS resources. Chuck.
Thank you, Philip. Let me start off by apologizing to those in the audience that have heard this report before, because this is the third time I've given it, but it is important background information for this particular issue. At the beginning of this year in January, the VeriSign Registry started to experience a significant rush to re-register deleted names. As the year went on, that escalated, and in July, we started to experience problems for registrars accessing the shared registration system through the RRP. On July 17th, in fact, we took the first steps to try and mediate that problem. And at that time, for the first time, we put some limits on the connections that registrars could have. We set a limit of a maximum of 250 connections per registrar and a maximum bandwidth of 256 kilobits. That did not solve the problem. In early August, the demand for the system resources became worse and reached, in fact, a critical level. We received increasing complaints that some registrars could not access the system at all, and also received increasing reports of poor performance when they did get a connection. Unfortunately, the result was especially bad on quite a few small registrars. The basic problem related to the activities of a limited number of registrars who were consuming an inordinate amount of system resources to perform a very small number of domain name additions. To give you some data to illustrate what was going on, there was a six-hour window in which we saw 40 million check commands. We saw single registrars executing as many as 1,500 attempts per second. The same registrar sending a check command for the same domain name in excess of 1,000 times per minute. We saw registrars executing in excess of 100,000 check commands for each successful registration achieved. We also saw some registrars who typically used only a single digit of connections expanding their connections over 200 times during these rush periods. So on August 8th, we took some additional steps. We reduced the connection maximum limit from 250 to 200, and we also implemented a new system that would guarantee every registrar a minimum of 4 connections so that the small registrars would at least be able to get in. That still didn't solve the problem, and what we experienced was that even though every registrar was getting a minimum of connections, there was still the problem of performance that was very limited, and so that was unsatisfactory. We spent quite a few hours consulting with impacted registrars and talking about how we could solve the problem. By August 10th, we decided that additional measures, some emergency measures, were needed to allow some time to better work the problem. So on after conferring with ICANN staff, it was decided that a timeout was needed in the batch delete process, where the problem was occurring. And so at that time, using a message that went out to registrars that we jointly prepared with ICANN staff, we temporarily suspended the deletion of domain names that were deleted out of the normal grace periods. On August 14th, shortly after we did that, 4 days later, we started posting the list of names that would have been deleted so that it was publicly visible what the names were, again trying to be upfront and open about what was going on, and made that available for registrars so they were aware of the names that were not deleted as they would have been. From August 10th through the 23rd, then, we worked very hard, our operations team in particular, to come up with some sort of a solution, temporary solution, that would allow for the resumption of the deleted names process. And we came up with the following solution that is in place right now. We added resources to significantly increase the number of connections available to registrars. And we created essentially three service pools. The first pool is what we referred to as the guarantee pool that guaranteed every registrar 15 connections. The second pool was an overflow pool that worked in sync with the guarantee pool, and it's a first-come, first-served pool where registrars, if they need more than 15 connections, they go over into that pool with the maximum limitation of 200 connections per registrar. Interesting note on this, 75% of the registrars who use the RRP, and there are currently 94 production registrars, actually use less than 15 connections on a normal basis. Then there was a third pool that was created that registrars could access through a different connection mechanism, and that was created to specifically accommodate automated batch processes that were being used to get deleted names. On the 23rd of August, we posted the information about this process and gave a description of the pools, what registrars needed to do if they wanted to participate in the automated batch pool. There were some rules with regard to the first two pools that required that they not do automated batch processes in those pools, and that monitoring would occur, and then we would follow up using some progressive steps if we saw that happening. 7 days later, that solution was implemented. There were 128,000 names that had built up during that time period. Those were deleted within a two-hour period on 2 o'clock that afternoon. And in fact, we have continued the batch delete process at 2 o'clock every afternoon since that time. I need to emphasize that this is a temporary solution, because it's a very expensive solution, poor use of resources for the amount of actual registrations that occur. So it's not something we wish to do on a long-term basis because of the cost that's incurred, but at the same time, something that we felt was necessary to deal with the problem right now and not postpone the deletes excessively long. Next step, in fact, this is an ongoing step, and that is working with registrars, the registrar constituency, in terms of coming up with a longer-term solution in terms of dealing with deleted names. And I can tell you that for 3 hours yesterday, a large group, a group of over 30 representatives representing mostly registrars, but also some of the other new registries, I participated in the meeting as well. And we met for 3 hours looking at alternative solutions, and that process is well underway with next steps defined. And I was very encouraged by what I heard from the registrars in terms of working with this problem, and I can tell you that we're committed to continue to participate actively in that process and work with them to come up with a longer-term solution to deal with this problem.
Chuck, your question. Clearly, your size is contributing to the problem in scale. Are any other registries experiencing any similar problem, or we simply would anticipate it might happen once their scale reaches something comparable to yours?
In any other registries?
Yes. See, I said that badly. Registries, yes.
Yeah. I can't speak for the CCTLDs because I don't have any data there. Of course, the new GTLDs, none of them are up and operational, so they're not even confronting the deleted names problem. But obviously, this is an issue that they're very concerned with, and they have communicated it in the registry constituency.
Rob Rossell, question?
In answer to your question, I happen to know that sometime last year on the .nl CyberSquatter went bankrupt and 56,000 names came available. And the knowledge leaked out, and on the date and the time the names would become available, and the registry suffered a lot of similar problems. So I guess it happens in operational registries from time to time.
So I would like to thank VeriSign for sharing its experiences with us and with everyone else, because solutions are clearly going to be needed. We have a question from the floor, Mr. Mariano.
Yes, probably this have be solved, this should be solved by some kind of change in the SRS protocol. But probably our experience in .jp registry is, you can refer to our experience, that our practice is that based on the, if the domain is once deleted, we set up some grace period, and after that, we set up some kind of, so we call the simultaneous application period, that the all the application came in this period will be deemed to come at the same time, and we conduct the lottery for these all the domain names application came in this simultaneous application period, and I think this system will release a little bit the problem, I think.
Thanks, Masa. By the way, I would like to talk to you further about that. We do also have a grace period after the deletions. It's a 5-day grace period, and that's designed in there to allow registrars, in case there is a mistake, to correct it in a small window, because once a name is deleted and re-registered by someone else, the legal mess becomes extremely more complicated. Yeah, but I will talk to you further about that.
Yeah, but I think the point is that when the time when the grace period ends, so that the also the simultaneous application period is very important in this power system. That is my comment. Thank you.
If I could characterize Mr. Narayama's description, if instead of being first come, first serve, it's random come, first serve, which is rather a clever idea. Mr. Hall.
My name is Robert Hall, and I had the privilege of chairing the meeting yesterday that Chuck talked about. There were registrars, various registries, as well as some third parties who play in this space, such as stamp names, present. If I can just run through quickly what the outcome of that meeting was. Chuck's alluded to some of it, but it'll also address the previous questioner. We came up with some basic principles that all parties in the room were agreed upon, and we reached consensus on them. I'll just run through them quickly. One was that it must ensure fairness, whatever solution.
Mr. Hall, you're being translated into Spanish.
A little slow.
So you need to slow down. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. We wanted to ensure fairness. The first principle was to ensure fairness to all ICANN accredited registrars. So we're speaking, of course, here about whatever proposed solution comes out of this. I'm speaking too fast again, aren't I? Okay. The second was, ideally, we wanted it to work within the existing protocols without major system changes to registrars or the registries. We realize this may not be possible, but the ideal solution should have minimal impact on the registrars. The third principle was we wanted to examine the root of the problem and deal with the root problem in any solution, as opposed to the temporary solution that was presented now that was basically a patch because of the symptoms. The fourth principle was we wanted any aftermarket gaming or aftermarket policies or solutions not to affect our current market operations, that being new domains, modifying and editing domains for our clients, and the deletion of domains. So whatever systems created must not affect our current operations for our customers. The last two were the solution must be timely. I think that is an obvious one for us, and done in conjunction with all relevant stakeholders. And I'll touch on that in just a minute. And the final one, of course, is it must maintain registry stability, not just for Chuck's registry, but for any new registry. We're looking for a solution that we can apply to all registries as opposed to one-offs with each registry. There were four proposals at the meeting yesterday brought forward, and again, I'll run through them quickly. The first proposal was to have an auction for all expiring domain names a la eBay. The second proposal was the one the previous questioner suggested, which was effectively a mini land rush period for them, where you would put weekly or daily batches of these domains to be deleted aside. Each registrar would have the week or the day to say, these are the ones I want, into a queue, and there would be some processing of the queue. We didn't get into whether it would be a la, you know, the info or the .biz model or some other model, but the idea was to take away the real-time processing that occurs now, the real-time gaming, if you will, that occurs now. The fourth proposal was to spread the batches out over the day, sorry, the third proposal was to spread the batches out over the day so that you didn't get this massive rush and to publish when the batches would be released and what was in them. So someone wanting, for example, rob.com wouldn't have to compete all day, but would know even down to the minute or the period of 15 minutes when that would be released, and only needed to compete during that time, because what we're seeing, of course, is that the problem spread out over a longer period of time. And the fourth proposal was to run almost, if you will, a parallel registry of people who wanted a deleted name where it was first come, first served. So if I wanted rob.com now, I could apply and say, I'd like it now, and pay some fee through a registrar, so it would be almost a registry service to registrars, where I would say, I'd like to be next in line, should it ever become available, and I might get a one-year term of that. So if the original holder of it deleted it, I would be first in line and automatically get it. So it's an additional service to registrars, opposed to domain names, who'd be selling the possibility of getting that domain name should it be deleted. The outcome of the meeting was we created a mailing list, and I'd like to take the opportunity to invite any interested stakeholders, because I know a lot of us are here, but a lot of us are not, to join the mailing list. I apologize, I don't have the address. I'll make sure it's posted on the DNSO website in the coming days. But what we've asked is that the presenters of each of these proposals who came up with it go back and develop a position paper fleshing out the proposal. And then after that, discussion will start on either amalgamating a couple of them or which one is advantageous. And we hope to work with the registries, the registrars, and any other relevant stakeholders to which one works best. So I would encourage people that have an interest in this to join the mailing list and get involved. We hope to do this again in a very timely manner. As Chuck said, the solution he has now, I believe, is intended to be temporary. I should mention that leaving the existing solution in place was one of the fifth options that we will be exploring as well. But I think, as Chuck demonstrated, it's a very expensive solution for them, and it copes with the symptoms we're seeing now, not the root problem that will get worse or get larger, if you will, as we bring new TLDs online. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any other comments on this topic or questions? Chuck, thank you very, very much. I'd like to encourage those of you who are interested in this problem to continue to work hard on it, because it's clearly of operational importance. Mr. Shepherd.
Chuck, thank you very much. Just before I introduce the final presentation, I'd just like to make a comment that when this issue was first alerted for names capture, something we discussed and decided to defer, in particular to the registrar's constituency, to dialogue with the registries. This has all happened in a relatively short time frame, and we believe the solution proposed and informed to the NIMS Council yesterday is one that looks satisfactory. We'll clearly be monitoring it carefully. But in terms of cooperation and speed of functioning between the users and suppliers groups in the DNSO, we're very pleased indeed with the outcome. And I'd just like to now introduce the final speaker, who is Patricio Poblete, who is going to report on the outcome from the CCTLD's meetings yesterday, which, as you would expect, naturally focus on the structural issues to do with the proposed new SO. Patricia.
Thanks, Philippe. This is a report of our 2 days of deliberations here in Montevideo, a meeting that I had the honor of sharing with my two co-chairs, Oscar Robles and Peter Dengel-Thrash. Committee of the CCTLD constituency meeting in Montevideo. Representatives of 65 country code managers met in Montevideo, Uruguay on September 6 and 7, 2001. A list of the country codes which were present or appointed proxies follows at the end of this communique. Their copy is printed outside, so I won't read that list. The country code managers record their grateful thanks to the Uruguayan meeting organizers for arranging this forum, for continuing the important work of the international component of ICANN. Considerable progress has been made in creating the country code supporting organization of ICANN, which is the topic that occupied most of the manager's time. Formation of the CC support organization. It will be recalled that in our Stockholm communique of June 2001, the CCTLD constituency reported that members there present had unanimously agreed to form a CCSO and to begin to work with the stakeholders in ICANN on implementing that decision. Members in Montevideo have developed a number of key principles that will be influential in the formation of the CCSO. Subject to further development, they are. Policy. There is a carefully definable set of global issues which can be put through the SO to the ICANN policy-making process. Each CCTLD is solely responsible for its decision-making, except for that carefully defined list of global issues mentioned above. When CCTLDs agree to be bound by policies formed through the ICANN process, the CCSO articles, bylaws, and MOU with ICANN, and any contracts signed between individual CCTLDs and ICANN, must ensure the integrity of the consensus decision-making process, including limiting that process to a set of issues, and to those issues within the ICANN mandate of technical coordination of internet names and numbers. The purpose of the CCSO is to protect and promote the common interests of CCTLD managers and their local internet communities, to give advice to ICANN on identified global policy issues within the context of maintaining global internet stability and interoperability. Mechanisms for maintaining good communications with the other support organizations will be established. Structure. The members of the SO shall be individual CCTLD managers. Members shall be able to give their proxies to regional or other groupings within the SO. A member cannot be a voting member of more than one regional or other organization for CCSO purposes. Border CCTLDs may choose within ICANN geographic regions they wish to join, self-selection. There would be a role for regional associations and other forms of associations which may develop. Initial responsibilities for the existing regional associations are the running relations with the CCSO Council, an integral part of any drafting process for policy recommendations to ICANN. There shall be a CCSO Council composed of 3 members elected by each region. The CCSO Council shall be responsible for conducting the election of ICANN board members. Board members shall be elected by direct election by CCSO members. Consensus building with ICANN stakeholders, outreach, and consultation with other stakeholders has also continued since Stockholm. In Montevideo, meetings occurred with representatives of 1. The business, intellectual property, ISPCP, non-commercial, and the generic registry constituencies of the DNSO. 2. Members of the ICANN staff and board. 3. In addition, much informal contact has been pursued with stakeholders. We have received either explicit or tacit support from all those that we have spoken to. Most see this as a justifiable, genuine, bottom-up self-organizing process. A recurring theme in our consultations makes it clear that our own stated intention of designing mechanisms for maintaining communications with other support organizations will be well received. We expect to continue this consultation process and will soon be commencing dialogue with the PSO and the ASO. A timetable leading to the development of documents for adoption at the November meeting of ICANN in LA has been posted. On CCTLD ICANN contracts, the meeting noted with regret that no response has been received from the ICANN staff to the completion and adoption of the CCTLD contract. Comments were received from the Canadian manager concerning the draft contracts submitted to the Canadian registry by the ICANN staff. The CCTLD constituency has agreed to cooperate with the Canadian registry in developing an acceptable CCTLD contract. Confirmation of a Latin American CCTLD association. The meeting received with pleasure the news that on 5 September 2001, 14 South American CCTLD managers have signed in Montevideo a memorandum of understanding to incorporate an association of Latin American CCTLDs, LACTLD. Congratulations were extended to the preliminary office holders. Signed the CCTLD constituency of the DNSO, Montevideo, Uruguay, September 2001. Later we had a meeting of the work group IANA CCTLD meeting, and this is our conclusions from that meeting.
Thank you, Patricio. Statement from the CCTLD managers meeting in Montevideo at the IANA CCTLD workshop, September 8th, 2001. I'll try to go as slow as possible for the interpreters. the ICANN CCTLD liaison established the CCTLD IANA work group at the Stockholm ICANN meeting with the stated intention of improving communication between IANA and the CCTLDs and improving the service from IANA to the CCTLDs. 29 CCTLD managers attended the Stockholm meeting and the same number attended the meeting in Montevideo on September 8, 2001. The CCTLD managers present at the workgroup meeting in Montevideo reiterated their concerns regarding IANA services as expressed at the Stockholm meeting. The major concern remains very slow action by IANA on legitimate routine technical updates, for example, notification of name server changes and unilateral changes to the schema of the database. We acknowledge and welcome the ICANN CCTLD liaison's good intentions to build links with the CCTLD community and to establish trust between the CCTLDs and IANA. However, we note with regret that these meetings appear to indicate that the IANA is unwilling or unable to act upon the clear consensus of the meetings. The effect of this creates doubts about IANA's intentions, and therefore the meetings do not have seen the effect intended, and may even have the opposite effect. Accordingly, we invite the CEO, ICANN, and the appropriate staff from IANA to attend the CCTLD IANA meeting in November in Los Angeles in the hopes of remedying the situation. Thank you.
Yes, Kim Falkman.
Yes, I'd like some clarification. My understanding in Stockholm was that the CCTLD constituency had essentially announced its imminent departure from the DNSO, like the end of June. I believe that since changed, and I do see the CCTLD constituency still working within DNSO and the Names Council and voting. Just if you could confirm that status and whether there's a timetable or perhaps its dependence upon the formation of the SO. Mm-hmm. But there was a strong statement at one time of leaving the DNSO, and that doesn't appear to be the case.
Thanks for the question and the opportunity of the clarification. We mentioned that date as the date after which we would stop making financial contributions to the NSO. The original intention was to stop paying after the end of the NSO fiscal year, which we thought was in June. Later, we learned that it was actually December. So in accordance with the spirit of the decision, we will stop making payments after the end of the DNSO financial fiscal year in December.
Kim, go ahead. And then,
just for my understanding, does that then translate into the fact that you don't participate after the end of December? You wouldn't be on the Names Council, you wouldn't be voting? And
well, but
like,
there will be
you have to pay in order to vote?
There will be an explicit statement before that date on that matter.
Okay.
Our timetable is such that we hope to have achieved final conclusion on the formation of the CCSO, or our proposal, for the November meeting.
Okay. Helmut, and then Alejandro.
I have a question for clarification concerning the CCTLD ICANN contracts. You complain that you did not receive any comments from the ICANN staff concerning the contracts. According to my knowledge, the CEO and also some ICANN staff is intensively negotiating and traveling around to understand the requirements from the CCTLD community. So could you elaborate this point a little bit further?
Yes, of course. Well, I understand the subject of contracts is scheduled to be later in the agenda, and there we're prepared to have more extended discussions, but
I can say that this remark refers to the fact that since at least December last year, and perhaps before, there's been available the final draft of the CCTLD community's proposal of a contract. And to date, we have received absolutely no feedback about that particular proposal that we've put forward.
Thank you. Alejandro.
Yes, I'll try to make all my comments in English, but I may have to resort to Spanish. I'll try to warn you when that point comes. I mean, a first reading would make you ask in English, is this a free ride or what? You stop paying, you skip voting. This is only a one way. We call it in Spanish a ley del embudo. This is a funnel which runs only one way. The usual complaint in the ICANN world is no taxation without representation, but it seems that here you have one of the groupings on the internet which most stands to benefit from a proper ICANN and a proper DNSO operation, which is sort of running circles around the payments and contract issues before coming to a definition. That's one first comment which I would like you to elaborate upon, and I'm making it intentionally very confrontational. Then I have another comment in English, which is, I am really surprised, the first time in the ICANN world in which I am surprised by a non-conspiracy theory. I mean, who else are you agreeing with about the major changes on the DNSO, the supporting organization structures, and so forth, that the CCSO would entail? I mean, there still is no explicit statement, for example, about the things that have been quite clearly stated before. You have said that the CCs are very special because they have to deal with both names and address issues. We only hear that you're leaving the main name, the names organization, and hear nothing of the new relation to the names issues, if there to the numbering issues, if there are going to be any. We have been hearing for days and days and days that there are, but I mean, if there are no numbering issues, then the CCs are not all that special for that account. Then we've been hearing for weeks and reading all the proposals for restructuring which come from the ALSC and so forth, and it really surprises me to see no comprehensive look at what the changes of the structure of ICANN, this CCSO, would entail. So this is not opposing the CCSO or favoring it. It's just, you know, the need of clarification. Is this happening really in a very isolated sphere, which happens, you know, in a different plane than we mortals live, or do you have a comprehensive proposal for the restructuring?
I will ask my co-chair to help with the second part of the question, so if you can come here to refer to the part of the CCSO. But to the first part of the question about this non-taxation without representation, I suppose we're all clear in that at the moment we're talking about stopping payments at future date, and a date by which we hope that things will be perfectly clear about the formation of a CCSO, which we expect would be the right way for our community to insert itself in the ICANN structure. Peter, can you help me with the...
Yes, I'm sorry. I didn't really understand the second question. Could you paraphrase?
Well, it's down to a very simple question. Have you begun, after all these months, to give any thought to the possibility that the CCSO makes a large change in the rest of the organization and what this change is?
Yes, and that's why, as the communique indicates, we have been undertaking substantial consultation with the other constituency members, and we've started the outreach in terms of other members of the staff. We had a meeting with the staff and members of the board, and there's been much, in addition, corridor conversation going as we prepare and discuss and negotiate.
So this has been in the matter of timing now. If you were to present a report of any kind in November, we would simultaneously receive the report from the at-large study committee, and also, I gather, something from the proposed CCSO, those two proposals may or may not be consistent, and so there may be a problem for the board to act on either of them if they both interact in some fashion that we can't even predict. But I want to make sure I understand that we may be faced in November with two different proposals, each of which might have a significant impact on the structure of ICANN. Is that the correct understanding?
Yes.
Okay, so I don't want to set any high expectations then for the November meeting. If we have proposals that have not been whose interaction has not been fully evaluated, we may have some difficulty acting on them simultaneously. I'm sorry, I'm Amadeo, please.
Get your translation devices, please. Dos preguntas. La primera es si creéis que
report on the establishment of the at-large mechanisms and the possible impact which this might have on the restructuring of DNSO. Do you think it could affect the manner in which you see our own CCSO, or would it even make you rethink this possibility? The second question I have is, Patricia has mentioned among the principles that there is agreement as to the fact that there are principles and global roles that should be coordinated through the ICANN process. Have you already defined what these global policies are, or have these not been included as yet in the document? Then there's the mechanism of a support organization is important, but obviously the contractual relationship with ICANN is even more important than the SO itself. Shall I reply in Spanish or English? Yes. Con respecto a la relación con las propuestas de...
With the committee, we're aware of the report, and we began some discussions with them. At the time, we are unable to provide, of course, a clear answer on that. We're hoping that we'll find some proposal that will be compatible, or that we can be made compatible with whatever other restructuring is in progress. On the subject of the global policies that we understand ICANN is may establish for CCTLDs, we do not have an exhaustive list. We do think that drawing up such a list is one of the most important tasks that must be performed, and very carefully. And we realize that there are matters that, as our community says, relate to stability and interoperability that must be established globally. But the most local, but for local policies, we understand that that is a matter to be decided by the CCTLD in consultation with the local internet community in each country. And for the third one, your advice, thanks.
Thank you very much. I have two comments waiting now from the floor. First, Jeff Newman from New Level.
Hello. I guess I have the opposite problem that Rita had. I think this microphone's made for taller people. Thanks. I just wanted to add a couple comments and just wanted to let the board know that we appreciate the work of the CCTLDs and the fact that they've come around to the constituencies during this meeting. We also wanted the board to know that we, the GTLDs, both the unsponsored and sponsored, have sent around a list of questions to the CCTLDs to answer. Actually, we sent that out in July, but apparently there may have been some problems with all the CCTLDs getting this questionnaire, so we've now resent it to the CCTLDs. We're also happy to see a statement by the CCTLDs that there is a definable set of global issues which can be put through the SO. We eagerly await to see which policies these are. And the GTLDs want to ensure a level playing field between the GTLDs and CCTLDs for the ultimate end user and the internet community worldwide. We are particularly concerned with these issues for CCTLDs that market themselves not as country-specific, but more as a generic top-level domain.
Thank you very much. Keith Gear.
Keith Gear from Real Names. Well, I'm really speaking just for myself in these opinions. I've probably spent the majority of the last 2 months traveling around meeting with CCTLDs, and I just want to share with the board some observations, or maybe one main observation, which I think is very important, and it relates a little bit to, this seems tangential, but it relates a little bit to John Clinton's point this morning when he reminded the board that with the creation of the new GTLDs, some fairly major structural changes are taking place in the characteristics of the naming system, from being previously hierarchical to now being subject-based, like info and so on, museum, aero, co-op. And that this transition clearly is of quite major concern to a country code manager who is used to operating within a hierarchical naming system where the top scope of the subject is a nation, and underneath that there are further definitional subdivisions in some cases, for example education and military and so on. And given those, what I would personally consider to be quite dramatic structural changes in the character of the DNS from a naming point of view, it seems to me entirely reasonable that the CCTLDs should have a collective and separate point of view about that. And I would ask the board to be incredibly sympathetic to the experience of the CCTLDs in trying to maintain a nation-based naming system within the context of a rapidly evolving global naming system. That's my point.
Thank you very much, Keith. Roberto Gaetano, please.
Muchas gracias. Voy a continuar la tradición de hablar en castellano. Patricio, tengo tres preguntas. La primera es, ¿cómo?
Whether the problem is that ICANN's staff is not moving sufficiently quickly to do things that the CCTLDs want. How is the situation going to change if, after being a constituency at the DNSO, it becomes a supporting organization? I don't see what's going to change in that. The second point, if the plan to make a reform of the ICANN structure, that is, having at large supporting organizations, we suppose that the plan is to have 666 or the three providers, consumers, and the third one. The CCTLD see a possibility for going into those plans in one of the three things, and then be different from the DNSO, but to go into that larger plane, I'd say. And my third question refers to, it's a reflection, in fact. In my view, all this is to make sure that you have seats in the board. Maybe, I don't know if this is true, but my question is very simple. if the CCTLDs want to make a supporting organization separated, would you accept a supporting organization without right to having directors in the board?
Those questions, the matter of some processes, and I assume he refers mostly what Pilar read our report, expressing our concerns about the slowness of the processing of requests sent to the IANA. We think those are separate problems. I have a personal opinion that most of what causes the delays can be streamlined, and those problems can be solved, so we could have response times in line with what one would normally expect in such a service, and not the very long times that we're experiencing now. And I do not think that that's related to us being an SO or just a constituency. It's a different problem. On the matter of whether our CCSO proposal will fit into the 666 structure or not, I cannot provide a response because we haven't considered that in any detail, and we don't have a consensus of our constituency, but Peter may provide some additional information, and I'll let him answer also the question about board seats, since it's there.
Thanks, Patricia. Can I just come back to a point about funding that Alejandro raised? It's important to appreciate that we're only talking about the funding of our share of the $15,000 to the DNSO. The board will probably be aware that CCTLDs suspect that there may be some merit in retaining a relationship with ICANN and have contributed somewhere between $700,000 and $1 million last year by way of voluntary donation. So the funding that we're talking about is the funding towards the DNSA constituency. Just need to make that clear. And each CCTLD remains able, as it has been, to come to its own decision about continuing those donations. There is no policy in relation to that at all. The second point was the at-large study. The board needs to understand that there has been no consultation with the CCTLD constituency about this study. The meeting day before yesterday was our first contact officially, and for many of us it was our first knowledge of or participation in any discussion about that study. From my own point of view, when I read it, I thought it had been written without regard deliberately to the CCTLD community. My own view at the moment is that it's not intended to apply to most of the CCTLD issues. If there are at-large members who have a problem in their CCTLD, ICANN is constitutionally and voluntarily unable to deal with at-large problems in relation to CCTLD registries. So the problems that the at-large is directed at solving is problems in the GTLD registries. Now, if there are problems in relation to the CCTLD registries, then they have to be taken up with the CCTLDs directly. So there seems to be quite a lot of communication and discussion to bridge that gap before we understand exactly what our role here is. So at the present, our position is that we do not fit into a simple funder, the split that's proposed. We regard ourselves as providing both registry services and for, in many cases, the needs of the users. And the hybrid nature of this responsibility that is the case in many CCTLDs and seems to be the developing model for CCTLDs seems to suggest that there is a problem in applying that tripartite model to us.
And there was a question about the number of board seats. Peter, do you want to take that one?
We have a range of views about board seats. The point about board seats is not for us so much a numeric point. It is that the CCTLDs are very concerned about the idea that policy will be made in the CCTLDs by ICANN. The important development here is the concession that the policies which they make entirely
on their own at the moment might be put through the ICANN process. Now, their concern is that while there is discussion in the consensus model of policies that are going to affect CCTLDs, that they have a full participation in that policy-making process. Part of that policy-making process includes board representation. The number of directors that will be required to ensure that CCTLD policies get a fair and adequate hearing is not yet determined.
Roberto, just one simple thing, since it's to you directly, I'm saying English. I really don't understand how the argumentation, if I understood it correctly, the argumentation about the fact that the at large is something that is related to GTLDs and not CCTLDs. The at large is related to the overall user community, to the people that are users of the internet, consumers, to the people that interact and that are not part of the infrastructure. So I don't see how it's not related to the CCTLDs. But can you just...
Well, it's a problem of definition of what the interest of the user at large is. We don't believe that's been carefully articulated, but if, for example, it's an issue relating to a CCTLD matter, then the CCTLD registry is going to be the place to solve it. More and more of us, my country included, have large policy-making bodies responsible for their registries. So if there's an issue relating to a policy in our country, it is to that policy-making body that one would go for redress or explanation or assistance. But not only that, it's impossible to get any of those things from ICANN. So if we knew more clearly what the issues were, we would be able to say, well, it can be dealt with here or here.
I have Denise Michel next on the list.
This is Denise Michel with the At-Large Study Committee. I just wanted to clarify a couple things. First of all, in the draft report, the committee has recommended for consideration 6 board seats for the At-Large SO and 12 that would be for the other supporting organizations. We have not recommended a 666, to clarify that. In addition, we understand that the CCTLDs have been very busy focusing on their CCTLD SO proposal and other issues, but we certainly have asked for their input and continue to, and met with them on Friday and are hoping that they do have time on their schedule to provide more substantive input into the draft proposal that we have issued. And Oscar Robles, who serves on the study committee and is also a member of the CCTLD, has also been helpful in providing information both to us and to them.
Yeah, this is Pindu Wong here. Just to follow on from Denise and from earlier points this morning, the ALSC has considered the potential impact of the formation of the CCS in Stockholm, since the communique very clearly indicated a potential departure. That was actually very timely because it changed the scope of our problem in assuming a static structure for ICANN. And that led to very deep discussions on this concept of 50-50 and the concept of balance. And when you create a structure for ICANN, which in theory is balanced for only one instant, and if there is a change in the structure, for example, with the introduction of a new SO or new numbers of SO, then that balance becomes becomes unbalanced by definition. So we have been very, very aware and are very interested in tracking to see what the developments of the CCSO. Again, I would like to reiterate what Denise has mentioned. One of the reasons why we have not gone further into defining sort of the 666, which people seem to misunderstand, we are saying 612, for two reasons, one of which is we don't believe it's within our purview to start looking at the details of the developers and providers. That's number one. Number two is very clearly that there is a work in progress there. And so from our perspective, we have made very serious considerations of potential impacts of the formation of a new SO as brought about by the consideration of CCSO, and welcome further relationship with this group in sharing ideas. Where this also relates to and may impact what we propose with respect to the formation of the at-large supporting organization, and to build on Linda's point this morning, is, again, we haven't specified the details of how such an ALSO could form in as far as organizations. And one point I mentioned this morning is that, well, you have all these internet societies out there, and you also have these local internet communities as being in touch with these CCTLDs. So perhaps the community could spend some time to consider what proper role the CCTLDs and the local internet communities could have with respect to the proposed at-large supporting organization. Input here would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pindar. We're coming to sort of the end of time for this activity. I don't have anyone else listed to speak. Are there any questions further from the board? Well, in that case, Mr. Shepherd, thank you both very much for your report.
If I may, just a couple of closing remarks.
Yes,
to end off.
Remember to speak slowly.
Indeed. Just a reminder that which underlines the discussion we've been having over the last 20-25 minutes. But as I said at the beginning of my presentation, we established yesterday a task force that will be looking precisely at these overlap structural issues, and we will be endeavouring to make our conclusions fit in as best as possible to the existing timescales that exist for the at-large report going to the board and the CCSOs. And in particular, I think questions that have come out of the LSA report, like the suggestion in terms of the providers, developers, users split, is something that has raised a number of questions and concerns in constituencies, and we're also looking at that issue and hoping to report to you on that as soon as possible. Mr. Chairman, and to the board, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I would like to return to an earlier matter that we addressed out of order, and for those members who are participating today who might not have realized it, we've already discussed the sponsored TLD agreements, and since some of the sponsored TLD representatives were not present at the time, I'd like to recall Louis Tuton to come to the lectern. Louis, I don't think we have time for you to repeat your entire performance, but perhaps some salient points could be reiterated to stimulate responses from the assembled group. Now I don't see Louis here. So much for the theory that we can revisit this point. Is that what you were trying to tell me? He's not here. I see. Thank you. Well, in that case, we'll proceed to approve some unwritten minutes or something like that to fill up the time. In that case, we'll come back to this when Louis is in the room. I don't want to have that discussion without his benefit, without his presence. So let's move on now to registration transfer rules, if we could, if Dan Halloran is here. And I think I see him dressed uncharacteristically and rather well. Mr. Halloran.
I'll just introduce myself in Spanish so you don't have to put on your things. I'll do most of it in English. Muy buenas tardes. Me llamo Daniel Halloran. Soy responsable de relaciones con los registradores para ICANN. Y perdóname, quisiera hacerlo en español, pero mi español no es tan bueno como mucho de el inglés de ustedes. Entonces, en inglés. Excuse my interrupting, but I just want to point out that Dan Halloran is one of our latest Spanish new hires in the organization.
Yes, I could tell that Halloran is clearly a Hispanic surname. It's quite clear.
Okay, back to English. Sorry. I'm Dan Halloran. I'm the Chief Registrar Liaison at ICANN, and I'm going to present the next topic, which is registration transfer rules. This is a very important issue for a lot of people in the community. For it affects registries, registrants, and registrars, and it's been a topic of a lot of discussion since Stockholm and online since then. There's an important tension between the two sides in this. On one hand, you need to protect community portability and also stability. The registrant should be able to move their domain from registrar to registrar to seek out the best service and price. On the other hand, they should also be protected from having their domain hijacked or slammed. These are kind of catchphrases in the industry, but hijacking would be where like a hacker gets your domain name and takes it away and does something with it. Slamming is when another registrar or their reseller takes the sponsorship of the domain without the registrant's authorization. The goal here and the guiding principle is very simple, and that's to implement consumer choice. When a registrant wants to change registrars, the sponsorship should be changed, but when a registrant does not want to change, the sponsorship should not be changed. That's very simple, but implementing it is difficult and requires lots of contracts and legalisms. The current policy is contained in the it's part of the registry registrar agreement for each CLD. Thanks, Ben. This is the policy on transfer ship of sponsorship of registrations in the .com registry agreement. And under current policy, the gaining and losing registrars share responsibility. The gaining registrar has to obtain express authorization from an individual who has the apparent authority to legally bind the registered game holder, has to retain a record of reliable evidence of the authorization, and has to provide the losing registrar with a copy of the authorization if and when requested. The current policy allows the losing registrar to deny a transfer request only under appropriate circumstances. It lists four, but it doesn't say they're exclusive. They're examples. If there's a pending lawsuit or UDRP dispute about the name, if the registrant is bankrupt, if there's a dispute over who the registrant really is, if the transfer request occurs within the first 60 days of the initial registration. So under those circumstances, the losing registrar is allowed to deny the transfer request. Recently, this goes back several months, it started to heat up just at or before the Stockholm meeting, but ICANN's been receiving complaints from accredited registrars and also from consumers about this transfer process. We've received complaints from some registrars that some of their competitors are not adequately verifying the wishes of the registrant to transfer. And we've also received complaints on the other side that registrars are improperly refusing transfers that were properly requested by registrants. We've often received numerous complaints from consumers that their domains are being held hostage. Losing registrars are denying transfer requests based on these complaints for two reasons. Either a failure to respond to an authentication request from the losing registrar, or an alleged failure to respond. In a lot of cases, there are technical difficulties which frustrate the attempt to authenticate it. Or the losing registrar will deny the request because the registrant failed to pay a renewal invoice for a registration that has expired, or in some cases possibly is about to expire or may soon expire. In response to these complaints, we put up a public comment forum on the ICANN website, which we've also got up here. When I checked this morning, we had 67 postings, and almost all of them, except I think one, were complaints either from consumers or registrars, resellers, about difficulties transferring names. Again, the same complaints that they're held hostage. I think there's one person on there who said they had no problem. We also received complaints through the Registrar Problem Report Forum, which is available to anyone for any kind of problems on the internet website. It allows registrants to put in their domain name and who their registrar is and what kind of problem they're having. We receive them and review them, and we don't have the bandwidth to go out and fix every single one of them, but we look at them and send them on to the registrar and try and keep tabs on them. So we've received many of the reports we receive here are also about transfer problems. On the topic paper that we put up for this, we have just another brief summary, sort of like I'm giving here, and then a series of correspondence that's gone back and forth between ICANN, registrars, the registry, and between registrars and physician papers about this problem, about what to do to fix it, and that's all available for people to review on the website. In response to complaints from registrars to the registry operator, since actually this transfer policy is part of the agreement between the registry and the registrars, the registry operator for ComNet.org sought guidance from ICANN's general counsel, and in a letter just posted a couple of weeks ago, he reviewed the policy that we had up there, the Exhibit B, and offered his interpretations to review of it, and he had the following conclusions based on the current policy. So this is just an interpretation of the existing policy. The letter, this is a summary. The beginning registrar, not the losing registrar, is responsible for ensuring that the registrant authorizes the transfer. The losing registrar may advise the registrant of the pending transfer request and allow them to object. The losing registrar may not deny a transfer request simply because it has notified the registrant of the request and has not received a response. The losing registrar may, however, deny the transfer request where it has an adequate reason for believing that the registrant has not authorized the transfer. And the letter went on to give a couple of possible elements of what might constitute an adequate reason for believing that the registrant has not authorized the transfer. These might include the registrant's failure to respond to notification, but that by itself isn't enough. Also, there might be prior communications from the registrant or the authorization practices followed by the gaming registrar, which is sort of where the whole discussion has now moved. The registrar's constituency is now considering what procedures should be followed by gaming registrars to ensure that transfers are in fact authorized by the registrant. In order to move to a solution on this, the community has two options. The registrars could develop codes of practice between or among themselves, multilateral or a series of bilateral agreements to develop codes of practice, or they could change the current policy, which would require going through the DNSO's bottom-up consensus process. And these are the solutions. And that's my thanks. And I'd also like to introduce Mike Pelage, who's the recently elected or re-elected chair of the registrar's constituency. Let's talk some more.
Thank you, everybody. This issue, as Dan alluded to, is very important, and it's important because it really goes to the essence of competition, the portability of domain names. And ICANN has been very successful in the introduction of competition among registrars, and we want to address this issue in a timely fashion because it potentially threatens the free flow or portability of domain names. A lot of my presentation I will try to glance through because a lot of the legal points Dan has thankfully covered. What I would like to do is actually focus on some of the realities of what happens. As Dan said, the current transfer policy allows a registrant, for whatever choice, either performance, cost, better service, being able to deal with a registrar in a native language, to transfer the sponsorship of a domain name registration from Registrar A to Registrar B. When this transfer occurs under the current policy, the registry receives a $6 fee. In return for this $6 fee, the domain name term is extended 1 year. Now, this may seem like a nuance, but it's very significant, because what happens is registrars generally try to time or coincide the transfer of a domain name sponsorship at the time of renewal, because then the renewal is able to take place simultaneously with the end of the original term, allowing them a $6 fee. It is, as you can see, a very cost-effective and economic move. Now, what happens is, if there arises complications in the transfer during say, the last 30-day period or the last 10-day period, what happens is, if the transfer is not effectuated, and the potentially gaining registrar attempts to reinitiate the transfer, if the term of the transfer has lapsed into non-payment under the list which ICANN has provided, non-payment is a basis for denying the request. So what is very important here is previously the most registrars acted in what we would call an auto-NAC, that when receiving transfers requests from the registry, they would generally acknowledge the transfer request. Unfortunately, there were certain registrars that began to employ a method whereby they would send an email notification to the domain name registrant saying, "Do you approve of this request?" And because of the very tight timelines, basically it was 5 days, a domain name registrant sometimes only had 1 to 2 days to respond to an email. And in some cases, with bulk transfers, registrants were actually getting 2,000 emails to respond to in a very short time frame. Although, as I said, I don't want to dwell on the negatives, and I'd like to focus on the positives, because the positives are that the registrar constituency, consistent with the ICANN mandate of a bottom-up, open and transparent process, has moved forward towards some consensus items within the constituency to address this and to move forward with competition, and I'd like to focus on some of those points right now. As Dan alluded to, this, because of the importance that this has to all registrars and to competition, we've had a number of in-person meetings and telephone conferences since Stockholm. The registrar constituency would like to thank Mr. Tuton for his letter dated August 27th. It was very significant in helping to resolve some previously ambiguous issues which the registrars had had. The registrar proposal, there are some principles that we would like to reiterate, and they're listed here. One, we believe that in light of Mr. Tuton's letter of August 27th, there is no need for any new process. We believe that the current proposal that we are putting forth fits within the existing contract and processes. As Dan said, transfers should only occur when the registrar transfer policy follows certain minimal standards. And what the registrars are looking to do right now are to address those minimum standards. The registrar constituency is also looking to come forth and identify certain mechanisms to provide recourse for a losing registrar if, in fact, the authorization was not approved. As far as next steps, the registrar constituency should be submitting this position paper to the registrar community at large within the next 24 hours prior to leaving Montevideo. There will be a one-week discussion period to ferret out any revisions, any enhancements, and again, the registrar constituency would like other constituencies to provide some input. We have been involved in outreach. I participated in a joint constituency meeting between the ISPs, intellectual property community, and the business constituency on Friday. We realized that having the input of users and other constituencies are very important. After a one-week comment period, we will put this forth as a consensus vote beginning on September 17th. So that is what I'd like to update. And again, in light of Mr. Tuton's letter, we have been able to make significant progress, and hopefully this will be resolved in a timely fashion.
Thank you very much. That certainly does sound encouraging. Are there any questions from the board? All right. I have someone listed as the potential speaker. Amadeo. Thank you.
It's a legal practical point. Could you explain what's the meaning of a constituency position paper within the ACAN process?
In light of Louis Tuton's letter saying that it is apparent within the current contracts that these items were discussed, the position paper or the internal policy document that we are putting forward would not necessarily need to go through any DMSO review, because this policy is not inconsistent, which is what is already put forth. It is actually resolving certain ambiguities, and the resolving of ambiguities does not require DMSO approval.
I would interpret this as implementation, in effect. But I have a, thank you, by the way, for that answer. I have Nigel Roberts waiting to speak. Oh, there you are. I didn't see you before. Please.
Thank you, Vince. My name is Nigel Roberts. Although some of you know me in a different capacity, I'm speaking in a personal capacity as an individual domain name holder. In the presentations and in the documentation, it's extremely clear that it is the responsibility and the obligation of the gaining registrant to obtain express authorization to the transfer and to maintain a reliable and secure record of that authorization. It is my personal experience, and those I believe of others, that one very large registrar has been unlawfully denying legally and lawfully authorized transactions. This has happened to me as the owner of Alderney.com, which I registered many years ago under the internet.net website and has been with the NSI registrar networksolutions.com since the split. When this happens, it clearly acts against the consumer interests. There is no doubt in my mind that the unreasonably short timescale to respond to email, the requirement that once again that you have to submit your authorization to NSI as well as to the gaining registrar, which you properly documented, within such a very short time scale is unreasonable. I've seen in the website that you put up on the board a few minutes ago the statement that ICANN only acts as a technical body and suggests that you contact, in the case of problems like this, your governmental and consumer protection agencies. And my question for the board is really this. Is ICANN a regulator for GPLDs, or is it not?
I wish that we didn't have a regulatory responsibility, but plainly because we establish contracts with registrars and with registries, we have a certain obligation to observe the performance of the incumbents. And so I think if that's considered to be a regulatory responsibility, I would assume we have some. However, I have to say that the scale of the organization is not such that it can deal with tens of thousands of complaints or whatever it turns out to be. You know, literally, dealing with the problem on an individual basis is quite difficult for the organization.
Actually, I think unless other board members have a point to make, then I think Vince has clearly answered the question. Sorry. I think unless other board members actually have a point that they wish to make, I think that's an effective answer. I'd just like to make sure that the question that I asked is actually put on the board rather than being rephrased. The question was, is ICANN a regulator for GTLDs or is it not? Thank you, Ben, for
The CEO has a comment.
The answer is we have well-defined contractual responsibilities in certain areas, and in certain areas we do not. Many of the customer complaints or registrant complaints we receive under our contractual arrangements need to be resolved by the registrar or registrar, depending on what's appropriate. What I think works best is the kind of thing you've just heard, where the constituencies themselves work among themselves to find best practices to address problems that arise. But we certainly, any complaints that are sent to us, we forward, and we try and get a sense of any general problems that exist. And if we see general problems, we try and discuss them with the relevant constituency and encourage them to work out appropriate solutions.
It does seem to me, to the degree that the board is responsible for policy and that ICANN is responsible to execute it, that if there are policy issues that could be addressed that would remediate some of this problem, that we are obligated to try to do that. I don't know that this is a policy issue necessarily, but if it turns out there is a policy problem, we need to take care of it.
Then, if I may, one additional item I'd like to make with regard to the registrar proposal is we have recognized the fact that there are other registries coming on board. This problem is somewhat, appears to maybe be unique just to the RRP or the FIN model. The other registries that are coming on, .info and .biz, they are EPP, which have an auth code, which may be able to provide another alternate means of verification. And one of the things that the registrar constituency has done is we recognize the dynamics of the marketplace, and the proposal which we are trying to put forth has been, shall we say, vetted through these other registries so that it is not just a short-term solution, but a solution that looks forward to many more TLDs into the future. I think that's important.
Just one other observation. It strikes me that many of the problems that we're hearing about have race-conditioned characteristics. That is to say, things have to happen in a very short amount of time. It may be that strategically, we want to look for ways of undoing the race conditions and find ways of doing authorizations ahead of time, all kinds of techniques to unburden all of the parties from having to react in real time to problems like this. We have Werner Staub now waiting to speak.
Yeah, my name is Werner Staub. I speak on this subject from the experience we could make directly with CORE on the subject. And I would just like to mention, with respect to the positive appreciation of the registrar constituency efforts to get consensus, that this is actually a little bit euphemistic to say that it is positive. The damage has already been done. For the biggest months of transfers, they have systematically been denied. Systematic damage has been inflicted on the registrars who were not able to transfer the names, and it has essentially been inflicted by the incumbent monopoly holder. That same organization has been awarded the ability to act in a dual role, and it has used the system that itself had set up, namely the transfer mode, which has a couple of inefficiencies, and specifically which has the potential, if it is abused, to cause costs to the transfer that are far, far above the potential profit a registrar could make. So indeed, I should simply make it be complicated to other registrars and increasing the cost of transfers, it becomes in the end utterly impossible. And for the last couple of months, this is certainly achieved, coincidentally, just after the network solutions, or VeriSign now, was allowed to continue in dual capacity. I think it is very important that in the future, the ICANN board looks at the potential that such a dual capacity can have in terms of designing a system that everybody has to use for the advantages of the incumbent.
We
Thank you, Werner. If there are no other questions, I'll ask Mr. Holland to becomes one. Mr. Cochetti.
Thank you, Vint. I won't take much time on this, but just a brief history probably is of some value to the board in putting the larger discussion in context. Since the interruption of competition among registrars, the VeriSign registrar pursued a practice of automatically accepting all transfer requests that came in. Beginning sometime last year, the volume of transfer requests or transfers noticed increased dramatically. And I think at the beginning, management in the VeriSign registrar assumed that this was the consequence of competition. Upwards of 50,000 registrations were transferring out of the VeriSign registrar each month. And the VeriSign registrar management accepted every one of them without question. Like any well-managed organization, the company began to look at why were customers leaving and began after a few months to do surveys of registrants who had left to ask them, have you left because of service? Have you left because of price? Tell me what was the reason? And continued automatically recognizing every transfer during this period. As an aside, I would note that the practice that the VeriSign registrar pursued during this period when it took a customer away from someone else was to require the registrant to send in a fax, which it kept on file so that there was no question that the new customer had opted to the VeriSign registrar away from the old registrar. The first round of market research took place in the fall of last year, and the results were surprising. I think everyone expected that there would be some volume of registrants who had forgotten that they had decided to transfer or who weren't aware of it, but roughly speaking, it indicated that about one out of four registrants who, it was a survey of registrants who had left, one out of four specifically failed to indicate that they had failed to, that they had indicated they had made no decision to change registrars. Another 10% said they had no knowledge of having made any such decision, and about one out of eight specifically said that NSI, then the name, was still their registrar. So when comparing this with a volume of 50,000 reported transfers each month, the results were surprising and disturbing. We were resolved not to jump to any conclusions based on this market research. It could well have been faulty, could well have been misrepresentative, and as a result commissioned a second program of market research, both of these being done by an outside firm using statistically representative sampling techniques. The second survey took place in April and May of this year, and the results of the second survey were equally disturbing, the results being roughly comparable. About one out of four reported transfers specifically said that they had not decided to transfer. Another 10% had no knowledge of transfer. And to be clear, this also means that two out of three recognized that they had transferred. So the whole picture should be clear. Not every transfer was at question, but a very sizable percentage of them were. Based on this market research, and after having automatically accepted about 600,000 transfers, we reluctantly reached the conclusion that we had to implement a higher standard of checking than what we had done previously. And as a result of that, we implemented a policy which is not unlike the policy of some other registrars. VeriSign registrars, not the only one that has a policy of carefully checking whenever it loses a customer, but we adopted a policy similar to policies practiced by other registrars, which was to carefully check and ask the registrant, have you actually agreed to go to another registrar? We made clear that this careful check was an interim procedure. We didn't. It's cumbersome. It's not ideal, and we are looking forward to a long-term automated solution that will make it easy for losing and gaining registrars to be sure that the registrant's wishes are being reflected. But until such a new procedure is adopted, we feel that we have no choice but to respect the wishes of our customers until they've made clear to us that they wish to change to continue to serve them. The point was made at one juncture that this has resulted in a request to registrants to verify that they wish to change in a very short period of time. And those who are familiar, Dan might well explain that the reason for this is that ICANN requires registrars, losing registrars, who are going to challenge a transfer to do so within 5 days. If the losing registrar fails to challenge the transfer within 5 days, then it loses its right to do so subsequently. So it would be impossible to give the registrant a month to respond if the ICANN limitation is a 5-day limitation. I think the general picture we would paint is a hopeful one, however, because we think that this is a solvable problem. Hopefully what all of us want to do is respect the wishes of the consumer, and hopefully what the whole discussion is all about is consumer protection, not registrar protection. And I think in that context the way that we have seen forward is one that is not fundamentally a matter of viewing this as a matter of a dispute between this registrar and that registrar over what is the appropriate verification techniques, but rather a question of how to ensure that consumers are protected and that whatever their decision is, that it is the one that is implemented. So we have an optimistic future about this being resolved in the spirit of consumer protection, and we look forward to working with ICANN management, with other registrars, other registries, in figuring out a way to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. Elliot Noss from Tucows. And then I think we'll try to draw to a close this segment of our public forum.
Thank you very much. I had hoped not to have to speak on this issue, but I feel I now must. I think first it's very important to note that I believe that I just heard Mr. Cicchetti say that despite what had been clearly communicated in the various correspondence on this issue, he was going to stick to his position regardless of that communication and regardless of any position that the registrars may come up with. That's what I think I heard. I think it's very important because the concept of this data and this marketing survey has been introduced in this matter, that I provide you with our perspective on that information. First, from the onset, we have been asking VeriSign Registrar for evidence of specific problems with specific customers. In operating our business, our first concern is to correct any customer intention that has not been adequately affected. To date, we have yet to receive one instance of a specific consumer issue. With this marketing data, and some of this is in the record of the correspondence that's been presented, VeriSign Registrar at one point presented us with a list of 32 names that they asked us, Tucows, to provide evidence of verification for. Within 24 hours, we produced detailed evidence of the verification that we had obtained from the registrant. No more was heard with those 32 names. Of course, there was no subsequent request. There was no indication of a deficiency in the information other than having it dismissively referred to in Roger Cicchetti's letter that's part of that record. That data was data that was relied on with respect to us to say, we spoke to 24 people, or sorry, we spoke to 32 people. We were able to reach 26 of them. Two didn't remember. Eight said they didn't transfer. This was the evidence that was presented to us. Our first concern, because we had those 32 names, was to see if there was a problem. We spoke to as many of those people as possible. Again, not with the interest of justifying a policy, but with the interest of determining whether there was something wrong in our process. We spoke to 27 separate people. 26 absolutely remembered authorizing a transfer, and one needed to speak to their NT administrator. I'll leave the operating system religious issues out of this. From our perspective, we felt that that had, at a minimum, gave rise to a serious concern with using this marketing data to justify this policy. Since that time, and in numerous discussions back and forth between the parties, in, from our perspective, continual attempts to resolve this problem, VeriSign Registrar has demonstrated a continuing unwillingness and lack of interest in either drilling down on whether there may be a problem with the data. In other words, we have offered in numerous ways, shapes, and forms to reach out to this group of people and see if there was a problem. You know, please don't take our word for it. Let's jointly go out and figure out whether there is a specific problem with these people that you're relying on to justify. Two, they had no interest in determining whether Two Cows had a specific problem with its transfer process. And three, and this I think is most important, they had no interest in determining whether consumers who they are purporting to protect with this step are actually being significantly inconvenienced, damaged, etc., from the imposition of their approach to the transfers. We think that that lack of willingness to drill down on any of those three issues speaks volumes. And I will repeat right here my willingness to continue to investigate specific issues. We ask again and again, please provide us with specifics. At the end of the day, the attempt to characterize this restrictive policy as a consumer problem not only doesn't do justice to the competitive harm it provides, but it also has, as is demonstrated by the message boards, thousands of our customers, what you've heard from other registrars, huge pain for consumers. Thank you.
Okay, now I note that there is some continuing interest in this topic. I have something from the net. Mr. Faulkner asked to speak as well. I want to just alert everyone to a concern that we also hope to finish at 6 o'clock tonight. So I hope we can keep our comments now very brief, if we could, Mr. Faulkner.
Yes, up until a few minutes ago, I thought that I was hearing very positive words, and as a board member sitting here thinking, and I'm not sure we have any actions on this tomorrow or not, but this problem was moving along and being handled within the constituency. And then we got some stories and maybe some emotions. I don't know if the various people, Nigel, Werner, Elliot, Roger, do you think this can be handled within the constituency, or is the ICANN board going to have to get involved?
Elliot, can I?
Her name's counsel.
I just have to be closest to the mic, so I'm sorry, Mike, please.
If I can, the registrar constituency at this point in time appears to have almost unanimity on this issue, but for potentially one registrar, which is a rather significant one. We continue to work with that one registrar to try to bring unanimity so that this will not have to go through, so that there will not be confrontation. But if that one registrar does not willingly participate, I guess we will seek guidance from ICANN on how to move forward.
Understood.
Yes, I might point out that several registrars have constantly asked me to get involved in this, and I have concluded that the best way at this point in time is for the registrars to work it out among themselves, and only if there is a constituency request for ICANN to get involved will we then examine whether it's appropriate for us to do so.
Before I call on Amadeo, I want to read a message that's come in from the net. This is from Kai Schetzel from ConActive Internet Services regarding registration transfer rules. And he says, it is good to have a losing registrar send out a receipt or confirmation request as a last line of defense against a fraudulent transfer. However, it should be quite sufficient to block a transfer if the registrant denies it. There is no need for an auto-MAC procedure. Auto-MAC, and by this I think he means auto-negative acknowledgement, that is to say rejection of the transfer, is simply a means of trying to stop clients to leave a supplier they are not satisfied with. The specific format required, and different for each registrar, the short time, and the fact that registrants are getting asked twice, puts too much confusion and hurdles in this process. Our clients have not chosen NSI as NSI claims. They came to us, not from NSI, and ordered a domain and some internet service. We ordered that domain from a single supplier available back then. Now we changed the supplier because of the bad service, and it's in our sole discretion to choose a new supplier. It's not up to NSI as the losing registrar to question our choice of supplier. I read that without any further elaboration on the deal.
Yes, I am a little bit nervous and skeptical about both Stuart's and Mike's approach that this should be resolved within the registrar's constituency. Indeed, this is a problem for registrars, and this is their main concern. But the goal of the rule is to preserve domain name portability in the name of customers' choice, not on the benefit only of registrar's commercial practices that may be aligned in this case, but in registrars only negotiations, other things could come to the table. And secondly, because many registrars are not members of the constituency, if I am not mistaken. So the consensus among the members of the constituency could only be a part of the solution. So I encourage that wherever you do or you happen, be sent to the Names Council for their consideration, their information, and I, as a board member, I would also like having their opinion on that.
As I said, Amadeo, we will be sending this out. We have been involved in outreach to other constituencies. What we are seeking to do is to revert back to the status quo, so to speak. If I can, just 30 seconds, a bit of history for the board. During the testbed period, there was actually an auto-NAC provision. The testbed registrars realized through their expertise and through their trial and errors that the auto act was the preferred method. That failure to act within a time frame should result in the transfer taking place. So there was an auto NAC originally in place, and it was changed to auto act. And we think that this is important, and we want to try to get back to that. The position paper that will be being put forward by the constituency is not a final paper. It is actually written in terms of an RFC. We provide framework and guidelines to work forward. As we said, this is meant to be a solution for all registries. We are going to analyze how this will work in an EPT environment. But what we need to do is to address this in a timely fashion, because as you have heard from a number of registrars, there is damage being done to consumers. We want to minimize this damage, return to the status quo, and then work forward towards a more permanent solution.
Thank you very much. I think we've drawn to a close this part of our discussion. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Mr. Tawash.
I'd like to now call upon Louis Tuton to return to the lectern. Louis, as you know, we inverted some of the order of our presentations today, and I believe some of the parties interested in your presentation with respect to sponsored TLD agreements may not have been present at the time that you made your presentation. We don't have time for you to completely repeat that presentation, but perhaps you could summarize the salient points about which the interested parties might wish to make comment. I also alert everyone now to the fact that we are somewhat behind schedule, and I will be trying to encourage brevity.
Well, the one of the very best of the features of ICANN meetings is that sometimes contentious issues get narrowed as the process moves on. And since the last time I was up here, I'm pleased to report that it has been narrowed. The issue on which I suggested that community comment might be good had to do with what to do about very small STLDs, permanently small STLDs, that is, those under 10,000 names, and whether it was acceptable, despite the fact that they had not, that none of the three involved here had addressed the issue in their proposal, that in such a situation they could avoid the expense of using competitive registrars as long as they stayed under 10,000. The development is that Aero and Co-op are gratefully so confident of their success that they don't think that situation is relevant to them. Museum always has had a much lower target, not much above 10,000 if their projections go, and would like to discuss the matter, and I don't know whether registrars have a view toward it. Just to clarify, what Museum has proposed is that as long as they stay under 10,000, they would not be required to use multiple registrars. Once they broke above 10,000, they would be required to use multiple registrars. And with respect to the up to 10,000 names they had in their own portfolio, they would then require the registrants at their next renewal date to select one of the competitive registrars.
Thank you, Louis. I see Rob Hall is on the list here.
Yes, this matter was brought to the attention of the registrar constituency at the end of our meeting, and we had a rather robust debate, I guess, or heated debate on it. I think in the effort to save time, I'll try and be brief. As registrars, let me start in the beginning. ICANN was formed in part to break up a monopoly and to create competition. And the way they did this was they created what used to be a monopoly registry that acted as the sole registrar. They created a registrant level with competitive registrars. We are not interested as registrars, and we do not feel it's in the best interest of consumers, to go back to a monopoly position by a registry. I think that some of the proposals put forward and some of the discussions that have happened over the last couple of days do exactly this, and they do it under different guises. One is, well, we'll create a testbed until we get to 10,000 registrants with a sole registrar. And in many cases, that's not even an ICANN-accredited registrar. They talk about resellers and downstream registrars that are accredited by them, but not ICANN. The fear seems to be coming from the fact that there won't be enough registrations and registrars won't be interested in the registries. What we've seen in our constituency is just the opposite. There is great interest by the registrars. In fact, some registrars have gone so far as to get together and say, where there may not be an SRS or an automated system, how can we help and how can we band together and maybe use an SRS translator or something, even down to fax or email for the smaller registries. Registrars already have people like museums and co-ops as our clients. Most of these people already have domain names, or we know how to contact them. We're already getting the calls from them saying, how do we get this? The last thing we want is to simply be reduced to a referral service to someone who is acting as a registrar but is not an accredited registrar but are providing all the similar services. So I guess the clear message we have is please do not allow registrars to be shut out or in any way limited. The only case I can see where you would allow a registry monopoly again is where no registrar wished to participate, and then you would be forced with a last resort. But it should be strictly that, a last resort, not a new standard you're setting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Michael?
As Rob said, speaking as the chair of the registrar constituency, this was the first meeting where the registrars actually did an outreach to the sponsored TLDs. Most of our efforts to date have been focused on the .biz and .infos of the world. I believe it's important in these contracts to look at past the startup stage. The registrars, it is very important that we contribute in the overall domain name process, and part of the problem has been looking at this startup phase. I believe the base contracts for all the sponsored TLDs say that at least one registrar will provide the servers. Because this was just brought up, this was actually the last item on the registrar's agenda, and what we will do is we will try to provide further outreach to figure out how we can work with these sponsored TLDs to move forward. There is universal recognition that these are very important as part of the proof of concept. They must work, and more so than the larger generic TLDs, these smaller TLDs only have one opportunity to work. They are not well-funded capitalist ventures. Most of them are nonprofits, and the registrars want to work. We want to be a part of them both at the start and in the future. Where this balance is, we've not reached consensus, or we have not maybe come to this particular balance, but we do want to work, and we do want to provide a role in these sponsors both now and in the future.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you, Louis, for bringing this topic back to our attention. I don't see any additional comments now, so I think we should move on to an update on the CCTLD agreements, and I see that both Mr. McLaughlin and Ms. Swinehart are scheduled to speak, and it looks like it's Mr. McLaughlin first. Do you care to use the lectern, or do you prefer the performance mic? Are you going to do a little...
My dance routine needs a lot more space than is available behind the podium. Okay, I'm going to do an update on the CCTLD agreements that were just posted and where things stand, and also offer some unsolicited editorial comment on some of the issues that arise. Ben, will you flip slides for me, or Rebecca? Thanks. Okay, so what just got posted? Over last weekend, we posted the long-awaited model agreements for CCTLD situations. We first posted a fairly lengthy CCTLD update document, which includes a lot of background and a lot of explanation for the text of the agreements. And I would urge anyone who's thinking about reading the agreements to read through the update document first, because it puts the provisions in context and makes a lot of sense out of them. They're intended to be read as a group. The reason for the posting last weekend was because we had finalized the proposed agreement with OUTA, with the .au namespace, and since the board was going to vote on it, we wanted to be able to present a package of agreements that covered both the situations that involve governments and the situations that do not involve governments. We had a sense, based on past experience, that posting one or other of those documents gets people very unhappy because they don't understand that there's a spectrum of available agreements. So we posted everything at once. We're hoping that this will allow us to do one-to-one negotiations while maintaining the principle of transparency for the CCTLD and broader internet communities at large. That is the balance. You cannot negotiate in a crowded room, but at the same time, everybody has an interest in seeing what you're doing. And more broadly, there is now text in response to this problem that the broad community can take a look at and discuss. Next slide, please. So this overview paper basically is the result of these last 2 years of face-to-face meetings and also constituency meetings where we've tried to internalize as much as we can about the different structures and situations and policies of the CCPLD so that we can structure agreements appropriately. It incorporates a significant amount of content from the drafts that were posted by the different CCPLD groups. If you look at the documents, you'll find that a lot gets borrowed. And as I said before, we include a lot of background on the history of CCPLDs in the DNS, including RFC 1591, the IANA news memos, and ICP1, which is ICANN's restatement of the IANA policies. Next slide, please. So let's go back and review why we're here and why we're talking about this. The goal is written agreements that will formalize and define the CCPLD relationships with ICANN. It makes those relationships transparent to everybody, the managers and their local internet communities, both, and also to try to solidify these relationships to make them more reliable for everybody involved. In addition, and maybe more to the point, in our memorandum of understanding with the U.S. government, one of the key transition criteria is to complete the language here is appropriate relationships with other entities involved in the Internet's operation. That means getting written agreements with the registries in the namespace and the IP address space, and that's what we've been working to over the last couple of years. Next slide, please. So the key contributions from the community, just to make the references here, include the CCPLD Best Practice Guidelines for CCPLD Managers, which was published by the constituency. There was also a draft, what they called a contract for services that went along with this. I've noted one key point here, which is that it reflects well-established principles of trusteeship and responsibility to the local internet community, which is what distinguishes a CCPLD from a generic or global TLD. In addition, there's a paper by the Governmental Advisory Committee called the GAC Principles. And two positive features from that document are that it emphasizes private sector leadership in this area and tries to develop a framework of accountability. One of the things that the GAC Principles does fairly successfully, in my view, is stress the need for governments to respect the role of the managers and to protect them against arbitrary governmental action. Next slide, please. Actually, go back one slide. One thing that I should say about the GAC principle, since it seems to generate some excitement in the CCTLD community, is that we have regarded it as a document aimed at governments. In other words, governments can implement the GAC principles. It's not something for ICANN to implement. So what you'll see in the agreements is that we have an agreement model which fits the GAC principles where they have been applied locally, and we also have an agreement model where the GAC principles have not been applied. So again, it's not our job to steer a CCTLD one way or the other, or its government for that matter, but to have options available to fit both of those situations. Next slide, please. So looking at these documents, there are a couple of key areas of agreement. The first one is that everybody seems to agree that it would be better to make these relationships more stable, more formal, and more transparent. And there seems to be general agreement that the CCTLD manager should be conceived of as a trustee serving the interests of the local internet community. Next slide, please. You can't really read it there very well, but the big picture is captured as most or many things in this area were best by John Postel, who said, the designated manager is the trustee of the top-level domain for both the nation, in the case of a country code, and the global internet community. Next slide, please. So, as I said before, multiple models are required in this area. Originally, we had the fantasy of being able to cook up a single CCTLD agreement that would work in all situations for all CCTLDs. That bubble has now burst. That's become evident over the last 2 years, and we are now working towards agreement models that are flexible enough to fit this vast diversity of CCTLDs. There are different management structures, different organizational forms, different mechanisms of accountability, different relationships or lack of relationships with governments. Next slide, please. So, boiling it down then, we have two basic situations. The legacy situation refers to the status quo we have now. This is the situation where the IANA, under RFC 1591, is responsible for monitoring these trust obligations. It's a very high level of monitoring, but it's a monitoring on behalf of the local community and the global community. The situation sketched out in the GAC principles is what we call a triangular situation. And in this case, the government, where it is interested and where it agrees to accept the limitations and burdens outlined in the GAC principles, can substitute for the IANA as the monitor of the local community's interest, while the IANA continues to monitor the global internet community's interest. Next slide, please. And so, given those two basic situations, we have prepared documents for each one. So for the legacy situation, it's a simple agreement between ICANN and the CCTLD manager. In the triangular situation, it's a couple of different documents, one of which is an agreement between ICANN and the CCTLD manager. The other is some kind of understanding between the CCTLD manager and the government. Now, of course, as we contemplate this, it requires both of those parties to agree for the document to be considered consistent with the GAC principles. In other words, the CCTLD manager has to agree to a structure that gives it comfort that this local community interest will be properly monitored. And the GAC principles outline limits on what the governments ought to agree to do. And then in addition, there should be, in a triangular situation, there should be some kind of communication from the government that indicates to ICANN that it accepts the arrangement with the CCTLD manager. Anyway, the bottom line here is that there has to be flexibility to accommodate these and a range of situations in between. Next slide, please. So the points to be covered in these agreements are redelegation and the principles that apply to redelegation, local and global policy responsibilities, again, the CCTLD being responsible for to the local community for its policies, and ICANN being responsible to the global internet community for policies relating to interconnectivity and technical operation. And the detailed definition of ICANN-IANA responsibilities is part of outlining that relationship. We've tried to do that in these documents. In addition, there's the problem of funding for ICANN to do the DNS coordination and the root server and other functions that are related to that, including the policy functions for the ICANN process as a whole. Next slide, please. So let's get into these documents a little bit more deeply without putting everyone to sleep. The triangular situation, as I said, applies where the government and the CCTLD reach their own arrangement. In that case, the document covers delegation and the standards for redelegation, which are to be worked out between the government and the CCTLD manager. The principle here, again, just to go back to first principles, is that no CCTLD manager is a king. None has a heaven-granted mandate to operate the registry forever. They can fail. They could go out of business. They could be unable to perform technical functions. They can lose the support of the local internet community. And there have been cases of that in the past. And the idea is somebody has to be in a position to do that, to do a redelegation where it's necessary. Under RFC 1591, it's an IANA responsibility. But as we've said many times, as the internet has gotten bigger, more people rely on it, communities get much larger, it becomes very difficult for the IANA to do that job. And we feel it's better, all things being equal, for the local community to be able to make those decisions within the local internet community and and for ICANN to play a much more hands-off role. To do that, the government needs to be substituted in some properly defined way as the guardian of the local interest. Won't be the right thing for every situation, but where it's possible, it's preferable. The topics to be covered are essentially what I mentioned earlier. The ICANN-IANA responsibilities include the root server system, a publicly available ccTLD database, and an audit trail regarding delegations, redelegations, and name server changes, and so forth. Next slide, please. In the legacy situation, where the government is not directly involved, we have posted a model memorandum of understanding. It is a very lightweight document. It's about 2 pages, and it's intended to essentially write down the existing commitments that ICANN has made and that the ccTLD managers have made as trustees. There's been a lot of grumbling among both the governments and the ccTLD communities about sort of trigger mechanisms, what conditions should apply for ICANN to be able to sign one of these. The government said in a couple of communiques, ICANN should send a blind letter to all governments in the world notifying them that we're beginning this process. That proposal met with stiff resistance from ccTLDs and others. And what we've attempted to do is strike a balance by pledging that we will keep governments informed in these situations, but we don't wait for some kind of affirmative consent before we go forward. Some governments have indicated that they don't want to get involved in this area, and they'd rather not get involved by being asked a rather pointed question by ICANN. So again, we're going to work this out in cooperation with the ccTLD manager to try to figure out the best solution for that particular country. Next slide, please. So, the progress to date, I'd say it's been steady. It's taken us a really long time. I was actually I was taken aback by several of the statements in the ccTLD constituency report earlier. One of the most surprising to me was the complaint that we had not reacted to the various documents that the ccTLDs have put forward. I've sat in rooms with ccTLD managers in this year where we've combed through their draft line by line, and I've given feedback, and I've talked to individual managers about it. Spend my whole life at ICANN for the last 6 or 8 months. I'm sure I haven't talked to everybody, and I'm sure I haven't talked to people enough. But we've been working really hard to give feedback, and I think you can see the summation of our feedback in the documents that were posted last weekend. They are about as comprehensive a response as I can imagine. Each ccTLD is different. We're going to have to work towards diversity. We're going to have to do face-to-face discussion and negotiation where possible. At the same time, there has to be transparency and community discussion as a whole. We'll try to facilitate that as best we can. We need to understand the local situations and matrix those into a global framework. That's the goal. The documents that have been posted are surely not perfect. I'm certain that we'll get good constructive comments and be able to improve them as well as tailor them to local situations. And as Stuart has said before, our objective is to be able to do about 5 of these a month when we get to the point where the texts are sufficiently final for people to feel comfortable with them. Next slide, please. So we're going to post a non-legal explanation of the current models. That was requested, and that seems like a perfectly logical thing for us to do. We'll be pursuing the triangular model. The triangular model is for those situations where the GAC principles are implemented. For every other situation, I think you should view the legacy agreement as a baseline and sort of work from that to see what might be appropriate for your own situation. There will be regional ccTLD meetings in the coming months. We're going to go to as many of them as is possible, and that will be a good opportunity to really go through these agreements in gruesome detail. And then we'll also be doing as many face-to-face meetings as we can. Next slide, please. This is my plea. Be sure to read that ccTLD update document because you'll find, as I said, a lot of detail there We'll try hard to avoid misunderstandings, and the best way to do that is to get it on paper. Next slide, please. Oh, yes. And now, in order to celebrate the CCPLD ICANN discussions from the last couple of days, I'm very pleased to present a proposed new logo for ICANN that I think captures the spirit of our dialogue and discussions, the incomplete nature of the discourse so far, and our hopes for the future. You'll see the old ICANN logo on the next slide, and my proposed new logo. Under construction. So hopefully we'll have a more complete Death Star report by the time of the next ICANN meeting. Oh, and I should also have Teresa come up for just a moment to wave at everybody, if nothing else. Teresa is the new counsel for international affairs at ICANN and will be doing the bulk of the work on contracts. So comments can be as usefully directed to her as they can be to me. Thank you.
And I suppose now I'm supposed to say this station is fully operational. I'm sorry, it's getting late in the day, you can tell. Mr. Thrush has his name on the list to speak, I believe.
I don't want to comment much about any of the subject matter. I just want to say for myself, personally, I regard this presentation, the fact of this presentation, to be very disappointing. I ask the board and the room to note that this is the only presentation which has not involved at all the significantly affected group. You have not heard, and you will not hear, from the CCPLDs who should be in partnership and who should be reporting to you as a partnership the progress on this important exercise. This is a typical part of our problem when we say we're trying to work with the staff and we get a top-down situation.
Well,
you just need to understand how we feel about this. We are not here in the presentation about our contracts. The actual documents themselves were posted some time ago. We've been repeatedly assured by the staff at this meeting that we do not have to read them. They will not be discussed at this meeting. Now, this might be characterizable as a PR exercise, in which case the question has to be, for whom is this PR directed? Because it is not working for us.
But Mr. Thrush, let me just ask, now that the documents are available, could we anticipate that there will be comments from the CCPLD parties, at least by the time of the November meeting?
Certainly the contracts will be reviewed.
Yeah. And we will hear from the CCPLDs, or the organization that represents them, yes?
Possibly. Can I suggest something for the staff? The suggestion, first of all, that it's a fantasy for there to be a single contract makes a mockery of the 3 years that we have put into reaching what Andrew has described as the CCTLD contract. We have worked through that fantasy and arrived at a single contract which we have presented. So we don't think it's a fantasy at all. And secondly, when we say there's been no feedback, what we suggest is that the staff, when they have done some work or they do want to contact us, they send a message to cctld-sec@www.tld.org. SEC. Now, that's how feedback to us goes to the organisation which responds.
Let me suggest that we take some of this offline. I have a feeling that we can resolve some of these matters. Do we have other comments? I see I'm having a room here. Vittorio Bertola is next.
Well,
Okay, I'm very interested in this issue because I am also a member of the policy board for the .IT domain, so I also represent users there. And we in Italy are having a very deep discussion about this issue. So one thing I want to understand is, okay, you say that the CCTLD manager has to act in service to the local community, and that ICANN, IANA, and then the government in the triangular model has to monitor that this happens, and if this doesn't happen, a litigation could happen. Okay, but are you going to, I mean, state somewhere, either in the context or as a set of guidelines maybe, what do you mean by acting in service to the local internet community? So maybe a minimum set of standards that a CCTLD manager must meet to prove that they are doing so, or for example, a minimum set of requirements in regards to the kind of input they must be able to receive from all parts of the community, so not just consumers, users, but also ISPs and registrars and so on. So I'm sure that ICANN does not want to enter into very local and national issues, such as, I mean, how the CCTLD is managed and how is it structured. But if ICANN has the responsibility of monitoring this, it also has the responsibility of, I mean, at least giving a set of guidelines that say, for example, that the CCTLD must have a way of receiving input from the community. So are you going to do anything in this field, or will you just leave it as a statement of principle?
It's a good question. I think the best way I can answer it is direct you to the CCTLD best practice guidelines developed through the CCTLD constituency. And also take a look at the drafts and see if you think they provide sufficient definition on the points you cover. What you say is indeed part of the problem. The level of specificity of that responsibility is a hard thing to put into words and decide about. So we have taken, in general, a very hands-off approach to measuring it. And as I say, read the documents and see what you have to say. Let me just make one note, just because it's been thrown on the table, and I think probably Vince's suggestion to take it offline is maybe the best one. But I'm surprised that Peter is surprised that we're having this discussion, because it's been on the agenda, it's been posted, and frankly, I think you get a sense of the kind of infinite cross currents that always arise when this subject comes around. If you don't talk about the documents, people complain that you're not talking about the documents. If you do talk about the documents, we've just heard a complaint that you are talking about the documents. So I see it as my responsibility to keep the community informed about what we've posted and why, and to give some bullet points about it. I don't think does anybody any harm. So in the coming weeks, as the managers do read through these contracts, I'm sure that it'll set up more face-to-face discussions. But let's not complain about talking about these things. Let's try to reach some resolutions.
All right, the next person who's asked to speak is Nigel Roberts.
Thank you again, Vince. I hope you can hear me this time. It sounds a bit louder. A lot of what I would have said has already been said by Mr. Thrush. He quite clearly expresses on behalf of the entire constituency a deep concern about certain matters of process. I think a lot of the problem that's arisen today is a matter of timing. If these documents had been posted 6 weeks ago, with ample time for us to take advice, appropriate advice, then perhaps we would not be feeling so frustrated, even if the contracts that are proposed were more outrageous than the ones that are proposed, although I think that's a little difficult. The main problem is that we have spent a lot of time and effort as individual registry managers and real money with professional advisors coming up with a contract which we think is equitable. Not one which is one-sided in our favor, but one which is equitable to ICANN, to the registry managers, and all other interested parties. This was formally transmitted to ICANN some considerable months ago, and it fell with a stony silence. Now, I know Andrew has done a very good job
in coming and talking to us, and we appreciate it. It's always nice to see him at our meetings. But I think we deserve to have a formal response to what we have put to ICANN, rather than simply ICANN writing something which, to my reading, is completely different. We also have a problem here of perception. Mr. Dengate Thrush referred to a PR exercise. There is a perception that it is entirely a PR exercise. ICANN's agreements with the US government require it to show significant progress towards establishing stable relationship with CCTLD managers. And a cynic, of which I'm not one, but a true cynic would probably say that this is a PR exercise aimed to show that you have in fact made some progress towards that goal. Unfortunately, the method in which it's done leads me to say you've actually retreated further from that goal.
The next speaker is Hiro Hata.
May I confirm the relationship between the CCTLD agreements and re-delegation? Do you consider that the agreement is needed before the re-delegation? That's my question.
There is not a firm rule that requires an agreement in the case of every redelegation. For example, if a registry were to fail as a matter of its technical capabilities and name service had been disrupted, I think ICANN would move swiftly through the IANA to execute a redelegation to preserve name resolution for the failed registry, at least we would try. So it's not like there's a 100% rule, but certainly we think at this stage in the ICANN process, a redelegation ought to be done with a formal written agreement, unless there's some very powerful reason not to do it, like a technical failure of the registry.
Okay, Elizabeth Porton.
Thank you, Lind. I am Elisabeth Bertinov from AFNIC French Registry. I've been already saying it several times. As you recall, Lind, the internet happened because we were putting together all this technique, and it was 15 years ago, and we are setting up a backbone, and we were partners doing so. And with CCTLD, we wish to be and we demand to be partners. That's the reason. There is no possibility to draft any proposal with CCTLD, I'm sorry to be so sharp, without considering us as partners. Partners in drafting, partners in looking on our issues. Partners, we are partners in setting up internet to have internet happen. We are partners in technical management of this internet. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Bart Rosenko is the next speaker.
I'm Bart Rosenko, the manager of .nl, the SEDN, which has passed this afternoon already for other issues. I just want to note that although the agreements have been posted very close to this meeting, it was already understood, I think, between center members and the ICANN staff that they will meet in black. I think that is the moment to go into the substance of this contract or the proposals, and we're looking forward to that discussion.
Could I just add a comment?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
I just want to mention to Bart that I think we are looking forward very much to that discussion with center members. I will point out, of course, what's obvious to everybody, that center is one group of countries and the many countries in the world with whom we have these kinds of discussions.
Patricia Poblete is next.
Thanks, I'm Patricia Poblete from NIC Chile.
I've had very little time to read the documents since they were posted when we were catching our planes, more or less. But I've went quickly through the document that introduces the two models, and perhaps I'm mistaken, but it refers to many other documents as sources, like our best practices documents, the GAC principles, and many others. But the one I have been unable to find as a source is the proposal of a contract for services with ICANN that the CCPLDs have produced. That one document is the one that we feel that has fallen on deaf ears when we sent it to ICANN.
That document is very similar to the legacy agreement that we posted. It should be, when you get a chance to read it, obvious, I think. The headings are largely the same. The structure is the same. Many of the provisions are, well, similar. I mean, we're lawyers, and so we get paid to change language. So some of the language looks different. But you'll find that it is an attempt to be very responsive to that document.
Why isn't there a link to that document?
I think there's a link on the CCPLD best practices document to the draft contract, and I think we assumed that all of the references were incorporated. Look, we're not trying to be obscure about this. There comes a moment in every CCPLD discussion where I start banging my head against the wall, and it comes usually when we start talking too much about that. These documents are not demands. The community consists of 244 registries, and I think you have to expect that there is a certain degree of ICANN posting something to the community rather than emailing it all to you individually, rather than giving you advanced copies, rather than trying to sit in a room with 280 chairs and try to negotiate it. It just can't happen. So look, you presented work. We've talked about it intensely over the last year. The documents that you drafted, we've gone over, some of you and me, in detail. And in trying to matrix all of this together, we've produced a response, model agreements for the two different situations from our perspective. So I hope that rather than complaining too much about when it gets posted, and as I said in the CCPLD constituency, if it irritates you, and I've explained, I think, already why it had to be posted when it was posted on the basis of the OUTA agreements, if it irritates you, simply regard it as the first posting for the Marina Del Rey meetings in November. It is a serious, substantive, responsive effort to get exactly into the issues that we've been talking about on paper, in text. So please forget about all the other stuff. Focus on the substance as a community. And if we work together, we can build a structure that serves the internet community that we're all dedicated to try to serve.
Sue Leader actually had her name next, but then I'll be happy to take you afterwards.
Thank you, SueLeader.nz. I have a question for the board. It possibly needs some background in relation to making changes to name servers, or even changes of address, moving from one building to another. We fill in a modification template. Changes to name servers are considered, technically, by IANA, to be a redelegation. Okay? Right. That's what we think. Now, we heard just now the same thing that seemed to be being said, and I'm willing to be corrected if I've misheard, same thing that was said at the CCTLD IANA workshop. And what seemed to be being said is except in cases of extreme emergency, the name servers are down, there will not be a redelegation without a contract. Could I ask when the board passed the motion directing that activity by the staff?
Mr. Lynn.
Sue, I suggest you read very carefully the email that I sent you, because nowhere in that email does it say that a name server change constitutes a redelegation. What it said is a technical contact change under certain circumstances might constitute a redelegation. A name server does not constitute a redelegation. Now, just to clarify some of the remarks that were raised earlier, and you know, one of the things that I hope we'll do, for those of you who will be at Bled, and then what I really invite is a good meeting in Marina Del Rey, is for us to start working with data and facts instead of broad statements. So I would like those of you who feel you've had long name server changes, I know Sue, you were one of them, to gather that data and bring it with you to Marina Del Rey, and we'll compare it with the data that we have, and let's see if we can reconcile it together. Because the data that we have shows that once you subtract off the often considerable time it takes to get response from the CCTLD, the appropriate people and information we request, that the time it actually spends in our house on the average is about 3 to 4 days. And there's also a time, as you know, as was explained in that note, that there's a turnaround from the U.S. government, but the time it takes in our house is about 3 to 4 days. So I explained that to you, I think, in a note. In your particular case, I also explained it took a little longer because it caught a summer vacation problem. But normally, on the average, there are 3 to 4 days in our house.
If I may reply, we have received your letter and we'll be responding when we get home. So I have to leave that there.
Good.
Could I just ensure I did hear a change of the name server is not a redelegation?
That is correct. If any of my colleagues want to correct me on that.
It's correct. I mean, one of the things you look out for when you see name server changes is you look out for stealth redelegation. So let me be clear. If you see a radical change in the name server that suggests that what's really happening is the operation itself is moving from one party to another and they're just leaving the contact information the same, even though it's soon to be inaccurate, that can you can analyze it and wonder whether it's a redelegation and investigate and ask for confirmation from the managers. But assuming that that's not the case, a change of name server by the same organization, that is the admin tech contacts as we know them, is almost by definition not a redelegation.
Fabulous. And therefore, not being a redelegation, it does not require approval by the Department of Commerce.
It does require approval by the Department of Commerce because it's a change in the root zone file. Changes in the root zone file are what gets approved by the Department of Commerce.
Okay, so there is no board policy that there will be no redelegation. In other words, we choose, for instance, to change our technical contact, which counts as a redelegation. There's no redelegation without a contract. Is not a rule of the board which has not been passed to the staff to enact.
The staff has been directed by the board in 2 or maybe 3 resolutions to move as best we can to get as many agreements as we can, as early as we can, to complete the transition. So as I said before, we don't regard it as being a 100% rule, but we think that where a redelegation is taking place, it ought to be done in the context of the formal agreement, which is the goal of this process. So the resolutions I'm thinking of would be Melbourne, perhaps Marina Del Rey last fall. I can't remember if the board said anything about it in Stockholm. But the marching orders from the board have been all steam ahead for written agreements.
So I understand correctly then that there is no requirement to have a contract signed before a redelegation will take place. It has simply been convenient in those situations.
We think that redelegations ought to take place in the context of a formal written agreement to solidify, make transparent and reliable the relationship.
But let me intervene for just a moment. Let's make sure that we don't have confusion here. First of all, if it's a change of name server and that's all, and the same party is operating, I wouldn't consider that to be a redelegation. If there is, in fact, a change of operator for the TLD, I would consider that to be a redelegation. And I believe the board has stated, if not in a resolution, then at least a sense of the board, that we would like staff to seek written agreements upon redelegation. Elizabeth didn't write down your name, but did you want to come back? No. Okay. Mr. Thrush.
Mr. Chairman, I think this is a problem, and we have already called in one of our documents for a meeting with the CEO and the IANA staff in Los Angeles. I wonder if before then there could be some staff papers ready to go to the board. I get the sense that many of the board are surprised, as some of we are, to learn that the instruction to move rapidly into contracts is being used by the staff as a means of withholding changes at the IANA database. I'm not sure that's what the board intended. I assume that the board appreciates the difficulty that there is in signing a contract, and to put a CCTLD facing a delegation or redelegation change under duress to sign the contract seems to be something that the board would not support. I may be wrong. It may be the board all understands that the staff is using this circumstance to try and pick off CCTLDs who need redelegation. If that is a board policy, then I think it should go through the usual process of establishing ICANN policy. And I ask, therefore, that at this meeting that we have called for in Los Angeles, that there be a very clear set of papers presented as to what the board means by instructing the staff to go ahead at all due speed with contracts, and whether the board approves of the tactic adopted by the staff of requiring CCTLDs that need redelegation approvals to force them under those circumstances to sign a contract. This seems to me a circumstance I'm not being fully aware of to be a major significant policy that should be going through the appropriate channels. So I ask that at the meeting in Los Angeles, some very clear statements from the board and the staff be available for us, and if necessary, that a resolution approving the current approach or rejecting the current approach be able to be taken by the board in Marina Del Rey.
Thank you. Andrew?
Peter's comment is directed at the board, so I don't want to get between you and that comment, but let me just say one thing about the terminology of picking off CCTLDs, because it implies the sort of, actually it embodies a kind of Death Star mentality about ICANN in this context. We really, at the staff level at least, conceive of this problem in a totally different way. This is not a labor management negotiation that we're trying to execute, in our opinion. Rather, we are trying to formalize a set of community service relationships in service to the internet community, globally and locally, in written documents that benefit everybody. And the agreement that we've posted that we call the legacy situation agreement is, by any measure, extraordinarily lightweight. It is, as I said, about 2 pages. It is general. Any party can walk away from it with 30 days' notice. It is designed to be the most rudimentary written documentation of our relationship that could be imagined. And given that we have indicated that this is a perfectly acceptable way to formalize the relationship, for now, at least, maybe permanently, but for now, it doesn't strike the staff as being an astonishingly burdensome or oppressive condition that we work towards a mutually agreeable document of that nature when executing a redelegation. We think of this as a community obligation on both parties to serve the internet in a transparent and stable way. Not as some kind of cherry-picking of CCTLDs to bring them into our evil empire.
Before I order the cream pies to be brought in so that the two of you can throw them at each other and entertain us,
Let me invite one more comment since you're at the microphone, Peter, but then I would suggest that we put this topic to rest for today. I would think the board would be interested in hearing more both from Mr. Thrush and from the staff about the nature of the problems you appear to be having, but today is not the right day to try to accomplish that, Mr. Thrush.
Just to say that we are not really interested in a further justification of this task force. I asked the board a question, was the board aware of this? And in any event, can we have some assurance that it's on the agenda for Los Angeles?
If you allow me a reaction on this issue, what surprises me is that I detect a sense that there are CCTLDs who do not want to enter any agreement with ICANN. And it gives me also a flavor that there is part of the CCTLD community which doesn't recognize the importance of ICANN in the technical administration of the Internet. I do also recognize that at least a group of CCTLDs in center are having positive discussions and interworking with the ICANN staff to further this. And I do not believe that there should be an explicit a decision or resolution by the ICANN board on this issue, because in the framework of the creation of ICANN, there is the establishment of an agreement between ICANN and the CCTLD registered as well. Thank you.
I could just try and give my answer directly to Peter on that question, that I believe, yes, I was, and I think the board was aware that, and it wasn't a resolution, but we understood that they were going ahead and in instances for revalidation would be seeking an agreement. That was then. And I think that was in, it didn't seem that rosy at the time, maybe looking back, expectation that within a short time frame, acceptable agreements would be arrived at. I think the request to review that approach in this environment is reasonable.
Querría pedirles que se pusieran los auriculares. Esta es una pregunta
to the president or the chairman of ICANN, Mr. Lin. I do not know whether this is the proper time and place, or whether I shouldn't ask this tomorrow, rather. Could you inform us about the latest developments with the language translation task force? Me alegro mucho de que me haya hecho esa pregunta.
President's report. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that up, Gilmore. It's an important point. Elizabeth, you did put your name past that, so please join us again.
Thank you, Vint. I am back to stress out that CCTLD, the majority of CCTLD, I believe, are really willing to work together as partners with ICANN. We have been in ICANN process since the very beginning. There was a lot of CCTLD sending funds to ICANN without even being requested. We have been awaiting for almost 3 years until now, observing that the major topic of ICANN were related to GTLD. We have been witnessing such things like extension of agreement for 1 year to sign 242 contracts, which I was summarizing as 242 countries in 242 days. We are willing to work together. We believe that there is more and more understanding, and there is more people, there is a lot of CCTLD willing to interact, being partner, and expecting that the next work plan for ICANN will give a considerable place to CCTLD issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I can certainly tell you, and my personal perspective is that the Internet isn't going to work unless we all work together, and as Elizabeth points out.
Mr. Chairman, could I finish on a happy note?
Would you mind if I completed my thought? I only wanted to say that Elizabeth got the note exactly right. We've been partners for a long time. We need to keep that up.
My apologies, I thought you'd finished. Sorry. What I'd like to do is leave you with the happy note, which I think has not quite been appreciated by the board, certainly by others. If I could just put up the CCTLD communique, policy point 2, and policy point 1. So I'd just like to draw your attention to this. I particularly want to reassure Hans Kranbrink about the existence of this. The significant milestone that this meeting has reached is that there is a carefully definable set of global issues which can be put through an SO to the ICANN policy-making process, and that the CCTLDs, although they're responsible for their local policy, accept that they will be bound by global policies formed through the ICANN process. Now, this seems to me to represent the biggest breakthrough in CCTLD-ICANN relations in 3 years, and it is the reason that there is a commitment to put policies through the ICANN process.
Thank you, Peter. Vani Martinez, please.
Hello, yes, my name is Vani Martinez from the Sustainable Development Networking Program Panama. When two parties enter in a contract, then they enter in an association within one contract. Yes. Then when a third party engage in any action, legal action against one of the parts of the contract, let's say in this case a third party enters in a legal action against the CCTLD, if I can solidarity with the CCTLD.
I think the answer to that question probably lies in the contractual relationship between ICANN and the CCTLD. And so I don't know that we can say with absolute certainty that under no circumstance, that in every instance ICANN would defend the CCTLD. Is there anything that is a, do we address anything of that sort, Andrew, in the contract that is proposed?
Well, at a non-legal conceptual level, it's very much our intention to strengthen the CCTLDs as trustees for the local community. We do our best in a limited way to provide assistance in places where the local internet communities are developing a capability to run the registry inside the country, for example. And the legacy agreement model that we posted is in some ways intended to help give some support to registries that need it when governments or others say, where is your authorization? Who picked you? It's a way to say, well, look, we've got a written agreement. So we're sensitive to that idea. So at the same time, as I said before, no manager is a king, no ICANN staffer or board member is a king either, and the goal is a balanced framework that makes everybody accountable to somebody so that the community's interests are best served.
Vani, just one other observation. It depends a good deal on the nature of the legal action that the CCTLD might face, to be extreme about this. suppose that the CCKLD is violating local country laws with regard to employment practices or was engaged in some other illegal activity, it's not likely that ICANN would want to undertake to defend the CCKLD against such a practice. On the other hand, if there were a redelegation matter, I would assume that ICANN would expect to learn about it and want to know more about it. And in some circumstances, especially with regard to the trilateral agreements, that might even be a party to the discussion about such a redelegation.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Danny. We've now come to the part in our session today where we can again address any open questions that the participants would like to bring to the table. If you wish to sign up and speak, the microphones are there before you. I do remind you that it's now 20 minutes after 5, and every minute that we spend discussing other things will keep us from the bar or other activities that might be even more fun than debating ICANN matters. But let me not stop anyone from coming to speak about issues that have not yet been addressed today or that will perhaps not be addressed tomorrow.
Jane Mutimer from Bird & Bird, a law firm in London and elsewhere, and I'm also Vice President of the Intellectual Property Constituency. Effectively, I want to raise a point which, on behalf of customers of Afilias, of which I am in fact one, this concerns errors in the .info Sunrise registrations. This is a separate point to the fraudulent applications which have been made and merely concerns matters of clerical error. What was essentially a customer service problem has escalated rather quickly into an intellectual property constituency concern after hearing Afilias' responses to concerns which were raised at the IPC meeting on Friday. Data regarding various Sunrise applications was corrupted in the application process. I don't know the exact magnitude of this problem. I know of at least 4 registrars whose data had problems in this way. In cases of which I am personally aware of, the A0 was entered somehow into the front of the trademark date, which made the trademark date from the end of the Roman Empire. I have clients with quite old trademarks, but not quite that old. The trademark registration number was replaced with a series of zeros, and any country which was not the US was replaced by the US. I didn't think this was a conspiracy. These results in trademark applications appearing facially unqualified. My reaction to this was initially, well, mistakes happen. There are bound to be bugs in any new system. A bit like the board member whose name was spelt wrong earlier today, and it could just be corrected. It's my understanding that many of the registrars have approached Afilias asking whether they can clean up the data which has become corrupted. They are even willing to give an indemnity to Afilias in relation to the amendments that they want made. Afilias' response was to cite the policy that the data is going to be locked for 6 months. Now, this is a problem, particularly in light of Afilias' statement that they will now challenge any facially invalid registration at the end of the Sunrise period. because this will put an additional unnecessary burden on the legitimate trademark owners who are in this position through no fault of their own. The costs incurred in obtaining an expedited copy of your trademark registration certificate runs into several hundred dollars for each mark challenged. I understand that affiliates are concerned that to permit any corrections to the record may permit further fraud to take place, and I agree that steps should be taken to prevent that. What I'm suggesting is that the original record should not be destroyed, that should still be able to be viewed, but any corrected data can also be accessed. And I also suggest that this clerical error fix be limited to registrars being able to correct what ended up on the WHOIS data on the basis of what their client originally gave to them. This would not allow the fraudulent applicant to now go in and make their fraudulent application look more realistic in order to attempt to avoid a challenge. It may also be of assistance to limit what fields can actually be, or what fields new data can be provided in relation to, just restricting it to the trademark data. If this sensible, limited approach, which appears to be what many of the registrars want and is supported by the intellectual property constituency, can only be made by a small alteration to the contract, and I think it may be possible to do this without any alteration to the contract, but I would hope that if it is required, that the board would be supportive of that. I appreciate that the rollout of the new GTLDs is proof of concept, but I think that if something is obviously broke, we could do something to fix it now.
Thank you very much. Mr. Narayama, please.
Thank you. I think this is all from my proposal that the subject is not limited. So I'd like to ask the board not to change the order of agenda suddenly. But this is because I think I should apologize for this statement, and a little bit rude statement I made in this morning. I truly apologize for that. I still think the substance of the statement is quite good one, I believe, but the statement itself is a little bit rude, I think. But let me explain the background for this, because for me, this item meeting is just like the fighting against each other with euphemism. So it's a little bit quite hard for the non-native speakers to prepare the speech, and it's quite hard. So please do not change the order of order of the agenda in order to give us enough time to prepare. That's my thinking. Thank you.
What I want to apologize to Mr. Narayama for not recognizing the side effect. I will say that I felt motivated by trying to make sure we got everything done in time to have this open microphone, so I felt some pressure to not simply let the time lapse, but I appreciate very much your observation. Mr. Holmes.
Thank you. Tony Holmes, speaking as chairman of the ISPCP. I would just like to make the board aware of one of the issues we discussed within our constituency meeting, and that was the issue of IDNS, and particularly the developments that have recently taken place at the IETF meeting in London. There appears to be a general move now towards client-side resolution of IDNS. And being aware of this aspect and the ongoing activities both within ICANN on the policy side and in the IETF, the ISP has concluded that the introduction of testbed capabilities would help to address some of the concerns which we now have, particularly with the multiple introduction of a multitude of different client-based applications. So to assist in moving this forward, and increasing the awareness across the ISP arena, we will now be drafting a paper outlining the issues and actively encouraging the introduction of testbed capabilities wherever possible. And the ISPCP members will then be carrying this paper forward into a variety of forums so that we can actually encourage the resolution of this issue.
I think the engineers in the crowd will certainly applaud. I have something from the net, Danny, if you will permit me to interpose this. This comes from Rachel McGregor from the internet community in the UK. This is a question that came up, should ICANN as regulator intervene at affiliates? Ms. McGregor says, although the affiliates rollout is a proof of concept testbed, does ICANN as regulator have any moral obligation to the .info Landrush customers to intervene and suspend the .info Landrush, since thousands of honest customers have been defrauded by false Sunrise claims, and that loss will be cemented if the Landrush proceeds? Does ICANN as regulator have the authority to impose the so-called dome-based solution or an alternative mechanism that protects defrauded customers whose place in queues otherwise become valueless? Do the moral obligations of ICANN as regulator overrule the experimental rigidity of the affiliates rollout because the experiment needs to be adapted or abandoned if the process has resulted in negligence? I thank Ms. McGregor for her observations. Danny, you have the floor.
Danny Younger, Chairman of the General Assembly of the DNSO. There was a time in this organization when we took advantage of the benefits provided by working groups. Working groups essentially allow hundreds of members to thoughtfully contribute to a given topic. Over the course of a period of time now, we have moved away from working groups to a task force environment. The General Assembly does not consider this to be positive. It allows us to send only one representative to a task force. Our experience has been these task forces result in a limited number of comments between a limited number of members, and problems are not properly addressed. While we are encouraged by the fact that the Dames Council wishes to move forward with respect to dealing with the issue of restructuring, we are looking for a broader degree of participation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hadn't realized that the definition of task force necessarily came with that component. Amadeo?
I have a question for Danny on this issue. I share your sentiment regarding your feeling regarding the working groups. The fact is that some of the working groups were really unworkable in the past, and these have a lot of a threat in the tendency to leave them aside. Do you have there are any procedural rules or any possible safeguards to have working groups that really can work?
The answer to your question, Amadeo, is that there has been a previous working group D that came forward with proper recommendations regarding how a working group should be functioning. Subsequent to that, the Council decided to issue guidelines with respect to future working groups to allow working groups to, in fact, function better. At this point in time, we are still awaiting for those guidelines to be released. We haven't seen them. When they are ready, we are prepared to move forward, but we do want to again express our concern that we aren't currently moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Danny. I don't see any other names shown here for open comments. May I ask if the board has any matters on the deal? Why am I not surprised?
Well, perhaps you're not surprised because I've been raising my hand since Andy McLaughlin finished his report. They even sent you an email saying that it was in the queue. There are some internal communications going through the board sometimes. Transparency is not for all communications. As a matter of fact, following your recommendations, I will not try to engage in the debate in my opinions, but I have some questions for Andrew regarding what he has presented, and I would appreciate if he can give some guidance on that. And I hope that the CCLDs understand that no matter what their sentiment about this publication, my obligation is trying to understand the documents that are on the table. The only thing is the action and how we implement the action on those documents. And two things. First, you said that in cases of negotiations with TLDs regarding the agreement, governments, I think that the idea is that should be notified. Passive verbs are useful because they describe the action, but not who performs the action. Could you explain whether, in your view, ICANN should notify about the negotiations or the content agreements to the governments, or that's something that we expect the CCTLDs or the community to do directly? The second question is something that I do confess bothers me a little bit. When you describe in your slides the triangular, another name I don't like at all, agreements, you say that somehow they follow GAC principles. Well, perhaps this can be a matter of statistics, but do you imply that ICANN should recommend or should impose following these agreements in those situations? Because perhaps the NIC and the government have some slight different ideas regarding that principle that are perfectly reasonable, but they might try to modify some of the principles themselves, and I don't see that we should force the GAC principles in those situations, if that's the reading of the slide.
Okay, those are both really good questions, and it's these are ideas that it's hard to express in a slide, so I'm glad you raised them. The first one was, what does the use of the passive voice in notified really mean as a practical matter? Who's notifying the government? And what we have committed to the CCTLD managers is that we will work with the CCTLD manager to figure out how best to notify the government. And my expectation is that that's going to depend. Some cases, they may want ICANN to pick up the phone, notify the GAC representative, or send an email and say we're about to do a contract. In other cases, they may prefer to do it themselves. But the basic principle is that this should not be a stealth negotiation in the dark that the government doesn't know about. At the same time, we said we are not going to wait around for the government to pass whatever decrees or resolutions it wants to do to urge it to get involved in this space. Which brings me to your second question, which is that our intended position is one of total neutrality. There will be some situations where the government will be involved, and we think it's important to have a model agreement available for those situations. There will be many situations where the government will either not be involved, will be in the process of figuring out whether it wants to be involved, or will be in active dispute with its CCTLD. And in those cases, we would look at this legacy agreement rather than trying to shove anybody into a triangular situation. A triangular situation is triggered where both parties, the CCTLD and the government, have agreed on something, and that something is consistent with the GAC principles. Look at Article 9 of the GAC principles. It's a 10 or 12 point structure of accountability that's supposed to provide protection for the manager, defined standards for the government, and a balanced and transparent framework. So we're neutral. If that exists, then we have one model agreement for it. If it doesn't exist, you look at the other one.
Okay, thank you very much, Andrew. I see that thanks to my colleague Amadeo, two people have shown up at the microphone in spite of my best intentions. Sundar.
I'll just keep this very short, given this open mic. Again, just want to remind everyone, the ALSC is charged with forging a consensus. We have much work to do, but we need your input to, again, develop and forge this consensus. So if you do have comments, constructive comments, please participate. In particular, we are looking for assistance with translation of our draft report into other languages. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bindar. Mr. Kempster?
Your Kempster, perspective, being so constituency member, I have been waiting for to hear the NIMS Council chairman speak about the review task force of the NIMS Council. And I do not know if the agenda will still allow us to hear, but there are many people who are clearly impatient to hear what is going to happen. And we are keen to hear the opinion of the board on how this should proceed, and especially on the timeline.
I would assume that having asked the DMSO for you know, a report and action on this, that we would hear back from them as to a timeline. I don't know whether we have.
Is it possible that Phil Sheffield be invited to report on the progress of the task force?
Phil is right behind you, coming down the aisle.
I apologize if you weren't in the room at the time, but I did my best to do a report, including the review earlier to the board, and including a timeline. I suggest that while I'm wasting everybody's time here, you look at the scribe notes, which have the timeline on. If not, please talk to me personally. I can give it to you then.
So I think that, yes, thank you. Mr. Josh.
It concerns ICANN approaching foreign governments, and I'm just concerned really for the safety of the corporation at this point. I've had this made this point to the staff before that there is no ICANN board policy concerning the contact by the corporation with foreign governments, and in a draft letter that the APTLD prepared, it suggested that before a California-based corporation started approaching sovereign governments, it might like to take advice from the US State Department that is experienced in such matters. I come from a country where we would be quite happy for to facilitate contact with our government officials. I have no personal concern. But what has always worried me as a lawyer and as a professional director myself is that the staff seem free under this policy or this lack of policy to choose among themselves when they will go and start negotiations with foreign governments. Now, I recommend to the board that you set in place a policy concerning contact with foreign governments and get proper protection for the staff in doing that. Seems to me that's likely to be one of the things that could put the corporation in some danger.
Thank you very much for that warning, Peter.
Oh yes, I wanted to share some concern regarding the ICANN steering committee, which was presented by Kato-san this morning. First, I would appreciate Kato-san's effort to try to bring the whole those issues in this area, and which is very sensitive and which is very complicated. But I'm a little bit concerned regarding the scope of this committee. We try to recommend the whole policies, which I'm not really so sure of, because if we see this whole process in the ICANN, you will see there's lack of participation from the directly interested parties. For example, there are some like people who use that characters right now, I mean, as domain names, in a very limited manner. They were here in this and this morning, but you could not have any response from them. That's sort of like limit which this community have had so far. So I think this is premature for ICANN to enter this multilingual related policymaking process. On the other hand, I'm so appreciative for that kind of effort to find the fact and all those like the progress in this field. However, I'm really concerned about this premature decision to let ICANN be another policy body in this area, as well as English domain names.
Ms. Park, I wonder whether you misunderstood the scope of the proposal. As I understand Kato-san's suggestions,
we want to do policy analysis and to understand what policy issues will have to be addressed. I don't think this is intended to make policy as much as it is to understand what policy is going to be needed. We've learned a lot from the existing Dominion system, and some of the discussions today show how much policy is needed. And surely for the internationalized Dominions, we will experience similar needs. My understanding of Kato-san's proposal is to begin that process to understand what policy requirements there are. Kato-san, would you care to amplify on that?
But I just want to repeat what Chairman just said. What we are proposing is now we are moving to a step further. We did several months of study, fact-finding on the issues, and we identified several challenges we are facing, both on the technology side and non-technology side. What we are recommending is to create a group of very broad people to coordinate among all ITN and the internet community to identify those issues and, if necessary, study and recommend some policies. We are not suggesting to make quick decisions or anything.
But if I remember correctly, the fact-finding process started from Melbourne, and right now it's been just like less than 6 months. And I think it is still premature to enter this policy analysis. And another issue is there are already organizations who have been involved with this language conscious and language specific issues, such as CDNC, which deals with Chinese meanings and Chinese cures, and INSEAD, which is Tamil speaking groups organization, and AINC, which is Arabic groups, and JDNA, which is Japanese. And there are already groups out there which have been coordinating these efforts, and I do really urge ICANN to co-work with those organizations.
Before you say what you want to, and on the veil, I do see your hand, I just want to ask whether you would be present tomorrow, by any chance. At that time, I would like you to hear the resolution that authorizes the creation of this working group. I hope you will discover that its intent is to consult all of the communities that you've just mentioned. Kato-san.
Well, again, Chairman just covered what I wanted to respond. The process during the last several months of fact-finding, we solicited a lot of comments from global ICANN and the internet world, and I'm very much aware of those international organizations, and there are many contacts and input from those organizations, and we are trying to coordinate, and we will continue to try coordinate with all groups for further study on this issue. But thank you for reminding this important coordination issue.
Amadeo, and then Mr. Morar.
Yes. Well, Jay, unfortunately, in DNS and internet-related issues, it's too early until it's too late. Things don't tend to wait for having the answer. So I think that all studies, research, and proposals should be encouraged. Whether it's the time to take any policy decision or not, it's something that would be decided at that moment. My personal feeling is that it's more too late than too early, but that might be simply my personal feeling. The second question was a question to you. In the tradition of transparency that I can have, that when somebody starts to explain something, they have to explain its affiliation regarding to that issue. Do you have any professional affiliation with any company or group that performs DNS-related multilingual services?
I think you may not get an answer to that. Mr. Tenstad, it turns out you are not next in line. There is another person, Roberto Gaetano, who is before you. I'm sorry, Roberto, I'm messing this all up probably because the day is getting late. I promise Mr. Morai next and then Mr. Gaetano.
Yeah, I just want to mention this issue, just why you raised is partially comes from the name of the group Kato-san is proposing, because that's a steering committee or steering group, and then probably that's a stirring and a very strong, you know, feeling, I mean, giving a strong feeling that, you know, controlling or policy controlling or that kind of a feeling. And I believe it's actually not that the intention, so probably that's one of the reasons. And, yeah.
All right, yeah, Mr. Gaetano.
Roberto Gaetano, since it's late in the day, I will spare you the headphone exercise. I would like to just make one remark. As you all know, the 80% of the participants to this conference has come from the 20% of the countries. It's kind of a Pareto effect. I would like to point out that there is also the other 20%. There's an effort from, as part of the effort of the Salzburg seminar that is administrating funds of the Merkel Foundation, there are some people that are came here with a grant, and some of those are coming from developing countries. And I met some of those in the corridors and or at breakfast, and I found it extremely interesting to have to hear those stories from countries that where I don't know how the internet develops, and in fact that follows different patterns. We have learned here from one person who was bringing his experience from Africa during the conversation. I was wondering, since these people are regularly coming, there's a couple of dozen of those people that are coming at every ICANN conference, whether we could think in the future to have a slot in the agenda, not necessarily, of course, in the open board meeting, but if we can keep this in mind in the organization of the next conferences, to give the possibility to those people to bring the experience that is so valuable for us to learn something about other places, and give them the possibility to tell us their story and the situation of their countries. Thank you.
That's actually a really intriguing idea. Thank you. Mr. Kempster, now you can take the microphone.
Yes. This is again the Chancellor. I'm sorry, I did find the reference to the brief remark that Phil Shepherd made. I was actually aware of it, but I couldn't believe that that constituted a report. I'm sorry. I still can't believe that this meeting in Montevideo is not addressing the issue at all. If possible, I would like to beg the board to discuss this with Philip a little bit deeper and ask him why the task force hasn't come up with anything, and if possible, lay down a timeline that something is done about it. Because especially since we are talking about reorganization of the board itself through the at-large SO and possibly the CCSO, the reconstruction of the DNSO into something that is going to work, and where there is a good balance of supply side and demand side in this industry, so that there cannot be an abuse of position of either the supply side or the demand side, is essential for the proper functioning of ICANN, and especially for the board to be able to receive proper, well-balanced policy advice from the DNSO. So if this issue could please be addressed by the board in whatever fashion is possible, we will not be totally frustrated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shepherd.
You open, Chairman. I'm struggling a little with the question. Jupp and I are people who live in neighboring countries in Europe. We've both flown enormous distances to get to Montevideo. And Jupp appears to be asking me a question via the webcasting facilities, microphones in here, and via yourselves as intermediaries of the board. I quite understand why I didn't just sit down and ask the question directly. But anyway, let me repeat what I said earlier. The report I gave to the board is not intended as substance, but a process in terms of the outcome of the task force called review, which is fulfilling its terms of reference, which were taken from some of the recommendations in the earlier working group report. That outcome will be an interim report issued in the next few weeks, posted with public comment, and following that, we would hope to have a final report by the time of the next physical meeting in Marina del Rey. Simultaneously, we have created a new task force which will be addressing the structural issues, and the timeline I promised on that to you, Mr. Chairman, and the board, was that we would do our best to match the imperatives of the external process in terms of the at-large and the CCSOs. And that's what I already have to say at the moment. It was not intended to be a substantive issue for this meeting.
Ms. Park.
Well, I was told I could not answer to Amadeo's question. So can I have a chance to answer to that question?
Of course you can, but who told you you could not?
No, I mean, I need to answer to his question.
Yes, by all means.
Well, actually, if I remember correctly, he was asking whether there could be any potential organization which might provide such kind of professional responsibility. Could you repeat it?
This one. Sorry, YJ, it was much simpler. It was, you know, in the tradition of the open mic. I simply was asking you if you have a professional relationship, if you work for or with an organization that provides multilingual domain name related services. This was the question. If you want to answer the second one, it also would be great. But my question, my previous question, was more simple.
Okay, I mean, my understanding is, do you have any professional? I think if I remember correctly, like Kato-san has been exposed to this kind of issues when he first attended the Mink workshop, when it was held in Melbourne together with Jonathan, and we try to identify all those issues. So for example, like Multilingual Internet Names Consortium, which was formed last year in Yokohama, and since its launch, it has held workshops in various places of 6 times, and altogether we have held like 11 meetings to raise awareness this kind of area, and there have been efforts to identify all these potential policy areas.
Thank you.
Danny, a brief comment, if I may. For the last 6 months, we have been looking at the review issues, and we're fortunate being in an organization that believes in openness, transparency, and I would simply ask the members of the board at their leisure to take a look at the review mailing list. I believe that you will find that there are no more than 10 comments that have been posted to that particular list, and we've been dealing with this problem now for 6 months.
Maybe you need to find some other way of stimulating interest, food, a party, and, you know, and some other excuse to get them all together.
The interest is not lacking on the part of the General Assembly.
Right, understood. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see that it's very close to the hour appointed to draw this session to a close, and I want to thank you all for an incredibly prompt ability to complete on time. If I don't shut up, we won't. So, ladies and gentlemen, let me thank you all for your participation, for your interest in the Internet, and your interest in ICANN. I call this meeting adjourned until tomorrow morning.